Senate Judiciary Committee will come to order. We don't yet have a quorum, but we're going to start with the revisers bill. Go ahead, you guys. I'm just going to sit here because we'll just have you go through.
That's the amendment. I need one too.
See what you mean. This is to the revisers bill?
Yeah. Oh. It's a House file now. Oh. The House file came over.
Yeah. Oh. Well, I guess the House file came over on this bill. Ms. Timmons?
Yes.
Will you walk us through, it's now House File 1200?
Yes, Madam Chair and members. I'm Michelle Timmons. I'm the reviser of statutes, and I'm pleased today to present to you the annual revisers bill. This is the one that comes through at the beginning part of session, the one that we try to make as non-controversial and probably as boring as we can. It contains three articles this year. The first article contains general provisions. Quite a few of them are things like terminology changes, changing to update terms, for example. Article 2 contains the obsolete and conflicting provisions, and these help us remove editorial notes that we have to put in the statutes when we find provisions during editing that are in conflict. And then finally, Article 3 relates to cross-references, and as you might imagine, as statutes are renumbered, recoded, we find quite a number of cross-references that are in error when we do our editing during the summer, and we've compiled those in Article 3. I would also like to note that Marcia Breisler is here from the reviser's office, and she's the person who has put this bill together and has much greater detail knowledge than I do if there are questions about particular provisions.
I believe that this bill, there's an A1 amendment, and Ms. Pontius?
Madam Chair, members, this is just another reference to the Crime Victim and Witness Advisory Council that we found that wasn't in the bill, and that was repealed last year. So
we'll, do any of the members here have any questions for Ms. Timmons on this? It's just basically a lot of cross-references. Ms. Pontius indicated that when they were putting this bill together, the language of this bill was circulated among the different councils downstairs, and the A1 amendment just adds a provision that didn't get caught in that revision. Ms. Timmons, if you can hang out until we get one more member, and then we'll take a vote on this for you. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you.
Let's see. Senator Higgins, can you go take your bill? We need one more person.
Okay.
To have quorum.
Go in the hallway and get my testifier, ma'am.
All right. Senator Higgins, Senate File 308.
Madam Chair, this is a bill dealing with the issue of getting blighted properties into the hands of people who can get them rehabbed and back out there to some nice family to live in. And maybe the Senate Counsel can give me advice about what particular pieces of it are before this committee.
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, I think it's the whole bill.
Okay. All right. That makes it easier. Now that I can actually find the bill, I'd be in good shape. Thank you. Madam Chair and members, the University of Minnesota study recently found that the University of Philadelphia study found that houses within 150 feet of a vacant or abandoned property lose a 7,627. $1,000 in value just by having a vacant or boarded building on their block or close by. In Minneapolis in 2005, there were 863 boarded or foreclosures. There were 1,610, almost exactly twice as many in 2006. Hennepin County was the same way. There were 1,682 in 2005 and 3,039 foreclosures in Hennepin County in 2006. Madam Chair, there are 800 boarded buildings in St. Paul. There are 400 boarded buildings in Minneapolis. And what we see is that the neighborhoods are becoming so destabilized because of the issues of the lack of investment in the neighborhoods related to housing. So this bill would set up a framework, excuse me, for putting vacant blighted houses into the hands of nonprofit organizations or churches who would then rehab the building and offer it for housing for low and moderate income families. Here's how it would work, and if you were in judiciary last year, you heard much of the same bill last year. The nonprofit or the church can petition a district court judge to have a nuisance property that has been unoccupied for at least a year put into receivership for the purposes of rehab. 30 to 60 days before the hearing, the nonprofit has to notify all the parties of interest. That would mean everybody on the title, including the lien holders, the lenders, the owner, any of those types of people. Also post the property, notify the county recorder or the registrar of titles, and publish a notice in the newspaper that they were going to go forward and have this hearing with the district court judge. At the hearing, the organization would submit a plan for rehab of the building. That plan must include showing that it has adequate funding to rehab and manage the property. Then the focus would shift to the owner of record. The owner or any party of interest, any of the lien holders and all those guys, could also submit a plan at the hearing to bring the house up to code and abate the nuisance property. If no owner or interested party appears with a plan, then the judge would consider the organization's petition. If the judge is convinced by the owner of record that the owner can get the house responsibly up to code, the court would grant him up to 120 days to bring the property up to code. The bill also provides for an extension period if there's good progress being made. So then that would all play out, waiting for the owner of record to get that done. If the property is indeed brought up to code, the judge would then dismiss the petition from the nonprofit. But after those 120 days are done and nothing has happened, the judge would then consider the petition from the organization. The court would consider the petition, check the resources issue, and then it could approve the rehab plan and actually grant temporary ownership to the organization. The organization would have to, of course, get all building permits and all those kinds of things that would be necessary, and would have 120 days then to bring the building up to code. During this temporary receivership period, the organization would pay the mortgage and lien holders just as if it had actual title. The bill also would provide that the organization would have to file reports to the court about the rehab and the subsequent use of the property for at least once a year. The report, as it's laid out in the bill, would include statements of all expenditures, including the cost of rehab, operation, maintenance, repairs, taxes, mortgage payments, and so on. It also would require the inclusion of any income and receipts. During the 6 months that the organization, or I guess it's the 4 months that the organization has been granted to bring the house up to code, the owner of record can file to regain his possession of the property. The judge would look carefully at the circumstances that might have changed that would allow the owner to get it together again. And it would be up to the judge to, you know, to stop the receivership and get it back to the owner. But if the owner doesn't file to regain possession, the organization can petition to actually transfer the ownership. Once again, due notice would be given to all the interested parties, and the judge could consider this petition and actually transfer ownership to the organization. The bill also says that the property must be used for housing low to moderate income families, and that the organization could at some point, if it found the need to, sell the property. We also say in there, at all points in the process, that any changes in the deed would have to be recorded at the county. And I have Perry DeStefano here to answer questions that I might not be able to answer. Madam Chair, we've got a serious issue with blighted housing. You know it. I know it. Lots of folks sitting in this room know it. And there are so many studies and reports that can show us about the difference that it can make in the neighborhood to have the downward spiral that blighted housing can bring to it. And this is one way that we can reverse the trend and get our neighborhoods back into shape again. So we'll. Do you want to say anything or just answer questions?
I would just add that 800 vacant.
Your name.
Oh, Perry DeStefano, Madam Chair.
How do you say your name again?
DeStefano.
DeStefano.
Yeah, yeah. Very good.
She's very close. I'm an attorney at Southern Minnesota Regional Legal Services. The vacant building problem is it's a bad problem, particularly here in St. Paul. And to give you an example, the 800 number was of last November. I was just in court and was talking with a city attorney, and already this year the number is 1,000 to 1,200. The fact patterns that I see that are causing problems is the equity stripper, the person that came in, took the equity out of the home, had no intentions of rehabbing the home, and just walked away, left a vacant building. The other ones that I see are the speculative investor. They kind of buy properties in different parts of the city, and they just bet wrong on this one. And fair market value is down. It's actually less than the mortgage, and they've walked away. Or the owner that can no longer afford to keep up with the property, keep up with the repairs for a number of reasons, and they've walked away. So all the fact patterns are situations where the current owners walked away and the private market doesn't have anything in place to fix the vacant problem.
Thank you. Before the members give you ask you questions, if there's a Ms. Amy Roberts from the Department of Education here, can you come and see Regina? She has a document that you have to look at before we get to your bill. Any questions for the witnesses? Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. DeStefano? DeStefano.
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 DeStefano. Isn't our laws regarding forfeiture, tax forfeiture, or the laws regarding bank foreclosures, mortgage foreclosures, contract canceling, isn't that enough instrument in order to allow these properties to be, in some cases, at least with the tax forfeiture, wouldn't that be enough instrument for the city to claim that property here?
Not the way the existing law is now, but a tax forfeiture would do, and remember, the city's not in the business of owning properties. And I'll give you a good example. It's a good question because I'm on the front line and I do tax foreclosures. Let's say there's a different law in our state, 504B, that allows an administrator to be appointed when there's people living in the building, and the cost of those repairs would be collected by special tax assessment. You can get repairs made on a blighted building that has people in it and collect the cost by special tax assessment. There's nothing allowing that to happen on vacant buildings. So so you would not get the repairs, and that's why you have the problem. There's no tool right now to fight vacant buildings.
Senator Lummer.
If there was a serious enough problem where the building is blighted, chances are it's probably not worthy to have an occupied certificate where you can occupy the property. Why isn't the city come along and just consider it condemned, or it's not up to health code, or some other consideration, at least to secure the proper property, get the tenants or owner out of it so that repairs can be done. We have those mechanisms, don't we?
Madam Chair,
Senator Higgins.
Senator Lummer. The cities do have that option, and these are properties that would already be under that category. These are properties that are considered blighted, and they have been vacant for a year.
Okay, Madam Chair.
Senator Lummer.
I asked the first question. We were talking of people that lived in the building, and that it was difficult to do repairs if someone was living there. That's why I was answering the question or following up behind it. I was reviewing the summary, and under Section 2, Subdivision 1, there's a reference that a temporary possessor would not be considered a taking of the property. But if we're talking ultimately of a property being owned by the city, that would be a taking, would it not? And is there any remuneration given back to the owner for that ultimate act?
What provision? I'm sorry.
Well, on the summary, this short piece.
It's the sentence that says that this is not.
Third paragraph under Section 2, starting with a proceeding may be commenced as a civil action, and then down on the second to the last sentence, would not be a taking of the property, but a remedy to abate the nuisance. Ultimately, when government takes something from a private citizen, it's considered a taking. And as a result of the taking, you have to give something back. Government has to give remuneration of some sort to the owner. Is there going to be that as a result of this?
Mr. DiStefano.
Senator, I've researched this. And the answer is going to be it depends. Now, remember the fact pattern you hear. You have a vacant property where the people have walked away in the first place. Often you also have the fact pattern where the fair market value of the property is less than the debt service, is less than the debt service, so it's over mortgage. Value is less than what the mortgages are. If there was a action brought under this statute to fix the repairs, so let's say you did nothing, there's no taking because the owner's getting zero anyways. He's got negative equity. What's also likely to happen is the person that has the second mortgage, let's say it's exactly like you said, it's a vacant building, it's on the list, it's going to get torn down. That's what's going to happen. Whoever's got the second mortgage is still going to get nothing because instead of having a home where there was some value, now you got a lot. And you got a lot with a special tax assessment with a big bill to tear it down. Now the first mortgager is going to get less. What this bill allows you to do is create a priority lien and give a mortgage or bank some incentive to reinvest in the community. So let's give you a fact pattern. And this is your typical fact pattern you see. Let's say the property is worth $150 now. Let's say it's got one mortgage on it for $100,000. Let's say it's got a second mortgage on for $100,000. And you'll see this. It's a very common fact pattern. Vacant building, someone took the equity out of it. It's worth $150,000, and the price is going down. If you do nothing and it gets torn down, surely the second mortgage is not going to get anything. If you the bill, if it goes through, allows the nonprofit to take a lien, $50,000, to fix it up. Well, then the fair market value would increase, just hypothetically, I'd say it goes up the same amount to $200,000. Well, then the first lien gets paid, second lien gets paid, and the first mortgage gets paid, and the second mortgager, who is about to get nothing, will now get $50,000. The owner would still get nothing because he had zero equity, and the property would be fixed. That's what the beauty of the bill is. It does allow the building to get rehabbed, and it's not a taking. Under Lucas, the U.S. Supreme Court talked about taking, and the state exercising its police powers when there's nuisance. And that is an exception, and it's constitutionally sound. And the cities of, or the state of Maryland, Illinois, Ohio, California, this passed constitutional muster in all those states. So it really is not a taking.
Madam Chair, Senator Limerick, another piece to remember is that in the case of a lot of the boarded buildings around, you can't find the owner. That owner has just picked up and walked away, and he's no longer a contributing part of the community. He's contributing to the downward spiral of the community.
Senator
Limerick.
I always thought that a person in a second position on a mortgage is running a higher risk anyway in the event that the property would devalue itself or if there was failure to make payment. The first rights go to the first mortgage or, and the if there's anything left, the second mortgage or would be in position to grab what's left. And they offer these second mortgages usually at a higher rate to absorb some of that risk. And they're usually for a shorter term. They want to get that loan payment paid off in a quicker time. But the risk factor can be high, especially in either a recessionary real estate market or if it's in a risky area of a city. And so I don't have a lot of sympathy for the second mortgagor in this case. Because they're already taking a risk, which they are well aware of. I can understand the position if you can sell that property for a higher value at a $200,000, such as you said. But if that can't be done, then the second mortgagor is out, and so is the nonprofit out, because now they're going to lose money on the deal. So I'm trying to determine why a city can't use its own mechanism to claim property that's already established. Is it a time factor? I know that tax forfeiture is about a 5-year window they have to wait. If it's a mortgage foreclosure, it's a lot quicker, as you know. So I'm trying to determine why do we need this.
Mr. Chair, one of the...
Senator Higgins.
You know, I'm really not with it today. I'm sorry. Madam Chair, Senator Limerick, one of the big issues that we find, for example, of leaving a house vacant and boarded, for example, for up to 5 years, is the fire possibility. More than 12,000 fires in vacant structures are reported each year in the United States. You know, resulting in millions and millions of dollars of damage, not to mention the hazard that it is for all those folks around it. You've been part of discussions that I've had dealing with copper stripping. Just having that unattractive nuisance sitting there for kids to get into, for people who are looking for a quick buck. For the meth users, for the dope dealers, for all of the problems that these boarded buildings cause, you don't want a property to sit there for 5 years. We have one in my district, actually about 7-8 blocks from my house. It's been boarded for 13 years, and if you'd like to see the phone calls that come in about that property, I know in my city we're trying to be more aggressive about getting some of those properties rehabbed. When we can find the owners, but in a lot of cases, we need the help of the nonprofits. We need the help of the churches, and they are willing to step up to the plate to do this.
Mr. DiStefano
Perry,
can you look at line 24 on page 1 in the definition of nuisance? And I'm having a little bit of a problem. It says nuisance means any property that, because of its physical condition or use, is a public nuisance, or any property that constitutes, and then it goes on. So
it's not clear to me why we would define nuisance as a public nuisance, because it's the definition here is not very tight. Does the rest of that definition sufficiently meet the need that you have for a definition of nuisance in this purpose, or are you intending to reference something else that we ought to make more clear on what public nuisance is here?
As an advocate, that's a great question. From 2.1 on, or any property that is unfit for human habitation by fire code, as an attorney, that's what I'd be interested in, going in and fixing the codes. That's right to the root of the matter. That's what I'm interested in. The senator might have some.
Senator money. Higgins?
And Madam Chair, I think most municipalities have a nuisance section in their city charter, their city code as well, that deals very specifically with what a nuisance is and how you abate that. You know, this ties in pretty well with that definition that I use in my other job, I know.
There are some that don't. I should mention, Madam Chair, that there's places out in rural Minnesota that don't have codes. So there should be some language in there that would kind of...
So if I'm hearing you right, Senator Higgins, you're intending the public nuisance reference here to be in reference to perhaps local ordinances where there are some?
Madam Chair, we do have a section of code that deals with nuisances. I don't know what it is or whether any of these reference it. Maybe that's 609.229, and maybe Ms. Pontius knows. But there is a section of state statute that deals with nuisance properties. What is the definition of a nuisance? Definitely reference that.
Well, for purposes of this definition, Senator Higgins, I guess I didn't know if you were trying to create a different nuisance definition, or did you want to cross-reference some other definition that's already in statute? I mean, we can't just say a nuisance is a public nuisance, because then we'll have to define what a public nuisance is, and it's a nuisance, which is a public nuisance. So it seems a little bit circular to me. Yeah. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If you look at page 2, line 2, there's an added reference to the term nuisance on line 2. Nuisance also means, and then they refer to a property application in section 15201 sub 4. But I don't know what it's also – it's talking as if there's some root form of nuisance definition. Because it says nuisance also means. So I don't know what that root form of nuisance is, but I remember discussion about the new changes last year in eminent domain reform, and eminent domain does have a definition of blight. And I don't know if that would add to this discussion or not, but I, for the purposes of this particular bill, I'm a little hesitant to get... I don't know what this would mean yet.
Senator Batzolder.
Madam Chair, I look quickly through the bill, and I may be incorrect, but it appears that the word nuisance, although it's defined, is really only is used in two places that I've been able to find, and that is on page 2, both on page 2, line 19, and then on line 34. And given the testimony that we heard, I think maybe what we can just simply do, because we are trying to define a certain type of property here, if we, on page 1 in the definition, line 24, if we just strike the clause that says that because of its physical condition or use is a public nuisance, comma, or any property, if we strike that language, the definition within this section of nuisance would be any property that constitutes a blight on the surrounding area or any property not fit for human habitation or any property used for illegal purposes and so forth, so that we get rid of the circular definition. And I think we probably would have almost everything there then.
Senator Higgins, are you amenable to that?
I like good editing, and that was good editing.
Okay. So, Madam Chair, I'll move then on page 1, line 24, strike everything from the rest of the sentence, starting with the word that, And on line 25, strike everything up until the word property. So we would strike the clause that because of its physical condition or use is a public nuisance or any property. So it would read, nuisance means any property that constitutes a blight on the, et cetera.
On Senator Betzel's motion, is there any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion passes. Just for the record, we did have quorum, or we do have quorum. Senator Limmer.
Yes, I'd like to bring the attention of the committee to page 2, lines 14 through, well, at least if we could refer to page 2, lines 19 through 21. This is talking about a petition for temporary possession. It recognizes that a nonprofit housing organization has a right to do so. They can file a petition for possession if the property's been continuously unoccupied by persons legally in possession for the preceding year. Just because a property is not occupied for a year doesn't necessarily mean that it's a nuisance or if it's even a blighted one, according to this definition. I guess number two, it does reference the property as a nuisance if it now is in agreement with what we just changed by the Betzold Amendment, that you're intending to rehabilitate the property. Does the owner have a right to say no without going to a big court case and spending their own legal defense money against now a nonprofit organization?
Mr. DiStefano.
Madam Chair, Senator, there is a right to a hearing, and he does have a right to object to it, as in any court. I would refer you to the hearing part. And also, he could always petition, if you look at Section 6, rights of owners to get restored to possession of the property. So there's a lot of due process rights for the owner.
Madam Chair, I'm thinking of perhaps an elderly person that may not have kept their property up as well as they could have if they were younger. And let's say they had a medical situation that they were sequestered in a hospital. And they don't really know what to do with their house, but it's theirs. They own it free and clear. Could this mean that if a person who had their home, they couldn't keep it up and were in a hospital for a year, a nonprofit housing organization could come along and slap a temporary order for possession on it?
I don't think so, because you need the two factors. It needs to be vacant, and if someone's in a hospital,
not living there, it says unoccupied.
Vacant. excuse me. You'd have a registered vacant building, registered with the city. That's what vacant is, and so you're not going to have that, and you'd also need nuisance. So not only would it have to be vacant, but it would have to have substantial, repair.
Chair, I think lines 17 and 18 should then specifically say that the property is vacant and registered with the city, rather than simply been continuously unoccupied. I think that's what you're trying to get at, isn't it?
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, I don't know if cities other than the two big cities have a vacant boarded registration. If I knew that, I'd be more comfortable with that. But if we had to say that it was on the VBR list, then all of a sudden this would be no good for any other city or area of the state other than Minneapolis and St. Paul.
Well, Senator Higgins, on that point, how would you factually show that some property has been vacant or unoccupied for the preceding year if
I mean, outside of the two big cities that do have these registration boards?
Madam Chair, most municipalities have some sort of inspections process, and the inspectors for those districts probably have a pretty good idea of what's vacant and what isn't. You know, they may be having the right orders to have the grass mowed, the sidewalks shoveled in the wintertime, those kinds of things. So you probably have a pretty good sense of how long that house has been vacant.
And Senator Higgins, the factors lines 217 through 222, those are and factors. So a certain property would have to fulfill all of those four requirements in order to be eligible for receivership.
Yes, ma'am.
Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
If an owner sent back after they had been given notice that they fully intended on living there or renting it or repairing it, does that act as a stop to this temporary petition order?
Senator Higgins.
Yes. At the hearing, as I said, you know, the owner could come in and say, you know, Judge, I had some problems, but I'm getting it together. You know, I'm fully ready to get the code violations abated, and I plan to rent this out. And we have in here that the judge could give them like up to 120 days to get that taken care of. And if the owner gets that all taken care of, then the petition is dismissed.
Yeah, sure, I'd like to see that written into the state statute.
It's right here, Senator Limmer, starting on 3.6. Oh, no, maybe I've got the wrong one. No, the respondent, that's the owner, right?
Mm-hmm.
3.6. Upon request, the court shall grant the respondent 120 days to bring the property into compliance with applicable codes, provided that the respondent provides a plan that's reasonably sufficient. And then we say that the court can extend the compliance period if there's good progress being made. And if it comes into compliance, then the court just dismisses the petition. So I will suspect that in some cases, what the owner needed was kind of a nudge. And having this kind of court proceeding would be what that owner needs to go get that property back up to code, and then we'll all be happier.
Senator Lemmer?
As I look at this on that subparagraph B, I take it the homeowner has to go all the way to the court hearing in order to petition to keep his home. And is there any way to simply respond to this seeking or petition for temporary possession of property by simply filing something, a notice by the owner saying, this is what I'm intending on doing in the near future?
Senator Higgins.
Senator Limmer, there isn't anything in here now that was the process that we saw would be done at the first hearing. The other way that the owner could have this dismissed was between the time that people approach him about, you know, and give him notice that they're going to take this action against his property, go get it brought up to code. That would do it, because then your four ands would not be applicable, because it would no longer be a nuisance.
Senator Betzel.
Chair, Senator Limmer, it does require here in page 2, lines 22 to 25, that before they even bring the petition in court, they have to mail to the party's last known address and post on the property at least 30 days, no more than 60 days, before the petition is brought, their intent to bring a petition. So that's a prerequisite of it. And presumably after they've given that notice, then they have to establish the fact that the property's been continually occupied for at least a year. It's a nuisance. It's claiming, at least make the allegations, it's a nuisance. Obviously, they have to prove that. And that the organization has to provide a plan to rehab the property, and then if the individual wants time to do it, then the court can grant it up to 120 days to bring it in compliance. So I think that the notice, the due process is there. I'm not quite sure what more would need to be done here to give notice to the individual, to the owner.
One reference I did want to ask
Senator Lemmer.
If it satisfies the requirement of page 2, line 19, the property is a nuisance, and we've already altered the nuisance definition that it constitutes a blight, do we have a definition of what blight is, at least for the purposes of this section?
Senator
Higgins.
Specifically for this, does the blight definition that we have already in statute take effect? Or do we have to reference it?
Well, Senator Lemmer, are you asking for a cross-reference, perhaps, to the...
I'm asking for a definition of what blight is for the purposes of this section in Subdivision 5, because that's really key to satisfying number 2 on page 219.
So, Ms. Ponte, is absent a specific definition, a specific reference, do we default to the whatever general blight definition is that's in the books?
Madam Chair, not automatically. I think a court might look at, you know, other definitions in law, but they're not automatically applied.
Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair, Senator Lemmer, we spent a lot of time last year defining blight for purposes of eminent domain, and it would make an awful lot of sense to refer to that and then incorporate that and then try to understand this bill in light of that definition of blight.
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, I brought that very same reference up before you came in. And I don't know if anybody went to look at the definition of what blight is according to eminent domain, but it might be something that we should visit.
It might
get
in, it might not, I'm not sure.
Well, Senator Lemmer, while this is not necessarily a taking, I mean, it's in effect, that's what it is without going through the process of taking title to the property. Senator Higgins, I would think that you might want to take a look at a cross-reference to that blight definition and see if we could do a cross-reference in this section to that definition of blight.
Madam Chair.
Senator Lemmer.
There's one other reference. I know that in testimony they talked about the rights of the owner and how they could perhaps repossess their property. Now, this, I think it was explained after repairs had been done. Does that mean that the owner, if they do so, are they legally liable for the improvement costs that went into that property? I know that if, let's say, I owned a property, let's say I was even the contract for deed holder on a property, and the new buyer that I had given a contract for was doing repair, and then they walked away. As the holder of the contract, I'm responsible for the payment of those repairs, even though I may not have thought they were warranted on that property, I become responsible for them. Does this mean that the nonprofit organization is going to be responsible for those repairs, or would it be the owner that may reclaim his possession of the property?
Senator Higgins.
Go ahead.
The owner would be. After all, the owner is the one that is responsible for keeping the property up to code. They wouldn't have done so. So what typically happened is, let's say it was in the city, the city would be sending owners, hey, you have 8 code violations, fix, fix, fix. They don't fix it. Say it did go through this process and the repairs were made. Starting on Section 6, 4.25 on, that whole paragraph talks about the owner in your hypothetical coming back, taking possession, and then having to pay for the cost of the repairs.
Madam Chair, what if the repair is beyond just bringing it up to code? Let's say the nonprofit decides to put crystal chandeliers in the house and a simple porcelain light bulb would satisfy the code requirement. What if there's a type of carpet that isn't necessarily, carpet and floor coverings are rather simple items for code compliance, but let's say someone went beyond just the code compliance. Would the owner be responsible for that?
Mr. DiStefano.
Madam Chair, Senator, I do a lot of these cases where there's actual tenants. This is like an administratorship, receivership. And that's the whole purpose of providing a plan for repair. You actually go in there with bids. You show the court, hey, here's the code violations. Here's the bids. Here's the work we're going to do. And then the repairs aren't done within a year. There's that annual accounting. And at the annual accounting, Senator, that's what's so good about it. Everyone gets notice of it. If there's any problem, there's a right to object. And naturally, it would be very odd that anyone would put a crystal chandelier in. But what do you think the judge is going to do if you did? You're not going to get paid for that. That crazy fact pattern, the contractor's going to get stuck with that. But that's not going to happen. Really, what's going to happen is they're going to come up with a bid. The contractor, you know, is a professional license. They're going to fix it up the bid so it's code. And then that has to be repaid. And if someone didn't agree to what was in the accounting, even the banks can do that. You could object to the accounting, and then the court will decide. So there is good protection for your concern.
Senator Lumber, Section 3 of the bill talks about the rehabilitation order. And in that section, it specifically talks about the court entering an order approving the rehabilitation plan. And then I think that if you read through that section of the bill, then in Section 5 of the bill, there's an annual report to the court. So that the court then, you know, actually, I mean, it's of what the expenses are, the repairs are. So there's somebody sort of keeping watch of the account so that no crystal chandeliers get put in. Senator Higgins, I have a question about line 413 to line 415 with respect to the liability. It states that the organization may not be held personally liable in the performance of duties under this section except for misfeasance, malfeasance, or nonfeasance of office. And that seems a little bit unusual. I only see or hear this in the context of political or, you know, office holders with respect to these three terms. And so can you explain a little bit how it would operate in this context, Mr. DiStefano?
Madam Chair, Senators, looking at the other states that have similar laws, they have that. Our own state has that. That language is almost word for word of what you'll find in 504B. And what that does, it gives the nonprofits some assurances. Hey, if we go in there and make repairs, as long as they don't, like, take all the rent money and run to Mexico or do something that's totally not negligent, they're not going to be held responsible. They'll have insurance. But, of course, if they run off with all the rent money, they're going to be liable.
Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, I had the same question when I was originally looking at the language, the nonfeasance of office. And then when I looked at that this is being done by a nonprofit housing organization, I was wondering, and maybe, you know, would this also include like a housing and redevelopment authority, which, you know, tends to be a government entity. Is that what was intended for the type of organization we're talking about here? I mean, Minneapolis may have its own view of what this might be, but I was thinking of an HRA, which would be a government entity.
But Mr. DiStefano?
Madam Chair, Senator, I was thinking of corporate contractors and looking at, like, 504B, where we have administratorships when there's other buildings. The legislator has passed similar laws giving the contractor some incentive. Hey, there's a mess going on. There's problems at the property. Maybe I don't want to make the repairs.
Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair and Mr. DiStefano, then I guess the Chair's question is appropriate then. If it's a corporate entity, how do you get misfeasance, malfeasance, or nonfeasance of office? You have that with government agencies, but you don't have that with corporate agencies, so I'm not quite sure that the language fits.
You could have a situation where a city entity would be, you mentioned like the HRA. I imagine the cities have community development companies that might be quasi government, right? And
but they don't fit.
Yeah.
Senator Higgins?
I'm sure they don't fit under this bill. This is nonprofits and churches.
It could be deleted.
Two entities.
Okay.
Besides, I always wanted to have a bill where I could do misfeasance, malfeasance, and
nonfeasance. Senator Betzel, are you...
Well, Madam Chair, I think the misfeasance, malfeasance, and nonfeasance, you know, doesn't work here. Then I don't know, you know, the policy question would be should the organization be exempt from any from liability performance duties? But we never give anybody a blanket exemption. You know, we normally say except for, and it's usually for some things like bad faith and so forth. Ms. Pontius is usually pretty good at supplying us a buzzword or two, but these are not the right buzzwords. So,
Madam Chair, let's take it out.
So, Senator Higgins, you want to delete this entire section? Delete those three words, the subdivision?
4.13 to 4.15.
And then connected with that, Senator Higgins, I'm also wondering, I don't see in the bill, but is there a place here that I'm not seeing where the nonprofit is maintaining insurance for the building?
I think so, Madam Chair. Let me see if I can put my glasses on and find it. I know that it Pardon says me? In here that the nonprofit has to stop talking, Linda.
Senator Higgins, can you see? Can you, Mr. DiStefano, think through on the insurance, liability insurance, and the liability piece of it for like a couple of minutes, and then we're going to bring Ms. Simmons up, and we're going to vote on the first bill that we pass, and then we'll come back to you.
Madam Chair, tell me more about what your issue with insurance is.
Well, Senator Higgins, if a nonprofit takes over the, a house, and they contract with subcontractors to come in and do all kinds of upgrades, while the house is temporarily in their possession, and in that process, what if lightning strikes or an arson takes place or something and damage, you know, causes damage to the property while in their possession? Who bears the liability for that?
Okay.
So you might want to think about that. All right, members, I want to go back to the Senate File 983. You can sit right there, actually. Senate File 983, which is the revisor's cleanup bill. We heard from the revisor's office. They have the A1 amendment, which is just another technical cleanup that didn't get included into the revisor's bill. So Senator Limmer moves the A1 amendment.
I do.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposing say nay. Motion passes. If there's no other further discussion, Senator Limmer moves Senate File 9. House File 1200. As amended. Be recommended to pass and re-referred to the floor, right?
Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
Let me note, this is the first time in 14 years that somebody other than me has carried this bill in the Senate, so congratulations.
Well, we haven't voted on it yet, Senator Betzel.
Normally, Madam Chair, in the past few years, we just sent the consent calendar, let it sit there for a while, but these days the consent calendar lifespan is fairly short, so I don't know. We could try to send the consent calendar, as a general order, as opposed to consent calendar. So.
Senator Betzel, I don't mind either way. If Senator, I'm going to put Senator Limmer on here as a co-author, and if Senator Limmer is amenable to that, I'd rather we just send it to this consent calendar. But
Madam Chair, we generally hold this toward the end of the session, so that if there's any changes. Other committees or other senators have reason to add something to the consent calendar. It's a sign off between.
Oh no, that's the other bill.
Senator,
that's the end of session bill.
There's an end of session bill. This
is the cleanup from the
yeah.
Okay. This is not that one.
So, Senator Limmer makes that motion that we send House File 1200 to the consent calendar. Any further discussions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion passes.
Sure, are you back to 308
yeah. now? Pardon me, Senator Higgins? We're back. Okay. We're back to 308.
Somehow in all of this work, insurance somehow got left out of it. So let's look on like line 317 after the period, inserting a new sentence that says something on the order of the organization shall have adequate and up-to-date insurance coverage for the property. And I don't know what the right terminology is, but
Senator Higgins, how about we let Ms. Pontius take a look at that for us, and maybe she can craft good language. Members, anyone else have any other questions for Senator Higgins?
Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
We never did act on line 4, 13 through 15 on removing the liability provision. You had suggested that.
You're right. We never did actually vote on that, I think.
Senator Higgins moves that lines 4, 13 through 4, 15 be stricken. Any further discussions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion passes. Senator Higgins, how long would a nonprofit have to hold a property in receivership?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, we don't say specifically. I would believe that would be part of the judge's decision. You know, if it goes longer than a year, we require that there's a yearly report. You know, at some point, the judge would I think, make that determination.
Well, I see on line 5.9 that says, if an owner takes no action to regain possession of the property in the 6 months following an entry of an order granting temporary possession, the nonprofit organization presumably may file a petition to transfer ownership. But in instances where they choose not to, they presumably could be holding the property in receivership for ever and ever and ever, or until the owner comes back and petition for the property to come back. So is it your contemplation that you want that possibility to be there, or do you want to have a, you know, instead of a may, maybe extend it a little bit longer and go to must? It's up to you. I mean, at some point, do we want nonprofit organizations to be holding 500-600 properties in receivership and managing those properties? And
no, Madam Chair, and providing here for, you know, the ability for the nonprofit to sell the property at an appropriate time as well. I don't think that any of the nonprofits that have been looking at this this bill and thinking how they could work under the parameters of it are thinking and holding them in for years and years and years.
Mm.
I don't think that does them any good. I haven't even thought in kind of those thoughts.
Senator Limmer.
Does the witness have any insight on this, of what they're intending on doing?
Mr. DiStefano.
Madam Chair, Senator, I've had personal experience doing administratorships, and I usually get a stern look if it goes over a year. The intent when we bring them, when there's people in, is to get the repairs made and then give them back to the owner under a different statute. So I guess I looked at it the same way that Senator Higgins did, and the repairs are going to be made. It's either going to be the owner is going to come forward, or they've really just walked away from it, and it's either going to be rented to low-income people or sold to a low-income person.
Senator Lummer.
Madam Chair, Mr. DeStefano, this bill would give the low-income or the nonprofit the right to rent the property out. It doesn't say for a year. It doesn't. They could enter into a lease agreement for an indefinite amount of time if they wanted to. But that may be contrary to the ownership period that the chairman is raising. And I think it's a good question to ask as far as how long a nonprofit can hold a property. If it's indefinite and it turns into just a great cash cow for the nonprofit, I can see why the nonprofit would want to hold on to it. They can make a monthly income off that. And if you multiply that by a couple hundred units in a city, I don't think this bill necessarily would prevent that from happening. And I guess my question to be as a public policymaker, the question that I would have to ask is, do I want nonprofits to be able to basically seize properties based on a definition of what blight is, and then they could even rent them out for an indefinite period of time? And that's basically what this bill, some of the rights that we will give a nonprofit to do exactly, or to exactly do. And I think it's an appropriate question to consider whether we put limits on this rather than have it indefinite.
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins.
I think you have two pieces there. The 5.11 that the chair brought up was the issue of petitioning for the transfer of ownership to the nonprofit and whether that should be a shall or a may. But you, I mean, they... You're thinking of it in terms of it still being in receivership and the ownership in the original owner of title, as opposed to this prospect where after all the work gets done, there is a process where the actual ownership goes to the nonprofit or the church. And that's what the section that Senator Watt pointed out was talking about.
Well, Senator Higgins, I just wondered... because it does raise some other issues. I understand this piece that's in Section 8, where at some point, right, in 6 months, the nonprofit could petition to do that. In and of itself, you know, is 6 months long enough for the nonprofit to feel like they could petition to do that? In an instance where the nonprofit chooses not to exercise the petition for the transfer of ownership, and let's say within those 6 months, there are six units, all the repairs have been done, all the repairs have been paid, presumably, out of the rent that have been collected. And what if the nonprofit is starting to book some of that rent, you know, on behalf of collecting the rent, even after they've paid all the expenses and paid themselves the fee, but there's accumulation of rent? I'm assuming that that gets booked in place for the, I mean, it gets accounted somewhere, banked somewhere for the benefit of the owner, correct?
Madam Chair, in the report that the nonprofit has to give to the judge, they have to not only list all of their expenses, but they have to list any income as well. And that would be another piece of information that the judge would consider and, you know, maybe the judge would decide that rent money would be used to offset the rehab costs. We didn't specifically put that in here. And we kind of left that for, you know, some of the judges' decisions. I think some judges are really going to dig into this and you know, take hold of it and really become a kind of a hands-on person working with the
region. Well, Senator Higgins, see what you think about council's suggestion here.
Okay.
Ms. Pontius?
Madam Chair, actually, this would be in the annual report section, so it'd be on page 4 on line 24. After the period, insert a sentence. I'll read it fast first. The court may establish a timeline under which the organization must complete the rehabilitation plan or bring a petition for a transfer of ownership under Section 463.276.
Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
That's fine. Elsewhere in the bill, it says that the nonprofit has 120 days to bring the house up to code.
Ms. Pontius. I believe that's the owner has 120 days.
It's in two places. If the owner decides to take it back and bring it up to code, he has 120 days. If the nonprofit is awarded the temporary receivership, then the nonprofit has 120 days. Either way, we're going to get
later than 6 months.
Madam Chair.
Senator Lummer.
One question I might want to raise is 120 days may seem like a lot of time, but I'd probably be more comfortable with 180 days. That's 6 months rather than four. And in light of winters sometimes becoming long, and if you happen to have an owner who needs to do some repair to bring it up to code, that would give at least a little more time to get through winter if, let's say, a roof needed to be replaced. And let's say they didn't want to hire someone, they wanted to do it themselves, which they can do. Or they could have some relatives come over and do it. But it would give a little bit more opportunity for weather opportunities for them to finish the job. I think 6 months is a reasonable time limit.
Madam Chair,
Senator Higgins.
We do have the 120-day period in there, but we also say that the judge can extend the period longer if there's good progress being made.
Madam Chair, we keep going back to a case-by-case, property-by-property case going back to a court. And we keep referring to the court having the kind of the control of this, but I think we could relieve the court of a lot of problem if we treated all properties with a little wider window, and that way things might get corrected on their own without taking up court time.
Madam Chair, Senator Lummer, that might be true. I know that in most cases your permits from the city are good for 6 months, so that would fit in that window as well. Your permits wouldn't expire in that 180 days. I think the last year's bill had 180 days, and I brought it back down to 120, with the idea that, you know, the communities have been sitting and looking at these vacant houses for at least a year and possibly years and years, so we wanted to get it done.
Senator Betzel.
Sure. Whether it's 120 or 180, the language as I read it right now is the court shall grant 120 days, which means exactly 120 days, I guess. You know, if it's something that's minor, it's still going to be 120 days. If it's something major, it's still 120 days. I'm just wondering if it might be more reasonable to say shall grant the respondent, say, up to, and then if it's 120 or 180, then the court at least has some discretion to fashion the time period around what actually needs to be done. And, of course, as it says in the next sentence, for good cause shown, the court can still extend the compliance. I think it's a little problematic to just to say it's automatically going to be 120 days when it may not warrant that one way or the other. So I think up to a certain number of days, and I suggest maybe, Madam Chair and Senator Higgins, if you say up to 180 days, the court can certainly say, well, it's not going to take you that long to fix this. You've got 3 months, and that's what you've got. The court can, you know, fashion the time period depending on what actually needs to be done.
Senator Higgins?
But how many days?
I can be flexible on the 180 if that would make people...
Madam Chair, I'll move that on page 3, line 6. After the word respondent, strike 120, number 120, and insert up to 180.
Any further discussions on Senator Betzel's motion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion passes. Language.
Madam Chair, members, on back to the insurance issue. Let's see. On page three, line 15 after the period, you could insert the rehabilitation order must require the organization to carry adequate insurance coverage for the property.
I'll move that, Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins moves the motion as read by counsel with respect to the insurance on page 3, line 15, after the period. Any discussions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say nay. Motion passes.
Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
On subdivision 5 on page 1, we talked of what nuisance means, and we redefined it by taking out some words. Basically, it now is read, nuisance means any property that constitutes a blight on the surrounding area, etc. Then on page 2, line 19, we still use a requirement that the property is a nuisance, even though it's a nuisance property by the separate definition on line 1. Do you want to continue using the page 2, line 19 reference in that same general requirement?
Senator Limmer, I think the reason why we try to make the definition of nuisance from line 124 to be more definitive is so that when you get to line 219, the definition nuisance is incorporated.
We also had a discussion, Madam Chair, with the page 2, line 17, where the property has been continuously unoccupied by persons. We had the discussion that some cities register these properties and other cities are unknown if they register them or not. If it's not registered by a city, could that lead to a conflict of definition? Would it be the property owner's definition against whoever the nonprofit that's seeking a temporary petition on? And how would that be resolved?
Senator Betzold.
It strikes me this is one of the prerequisites before you can even file the petition. Somebody is going to have to prove that. And frankly, if I was an owner, you know, trying to defeat the petition, I would, you know, somehow establish, well, you know, I actually had somebody living in for one day 5 months ago, prove otherwise, you know. And, you know, the person who brings the petition, the organization, is going to have the burden of proof. And you know, as Senator Higgins indicated, you know, maybe in Minneapolis and St. Paul they have a registry to establish this. I assume that would be sufficient. I don't know what other cities are going to do, but somebody is going to have to be able to establish that we checked it a year ago, we've checked it on a regular basis since, and we can, you know, the court's going to have to be satisfied this part's met. So I don't know whether we want to get into defining how that is to be met. That's just a responsibility of the organization that's trying to file a petition and go forward here.
Senator Limmer, I would think that that's a factual issue that the property owner could dispute. So they've got the protection, I think.
Madam Chair, I think the property owner has a lot of leeway in raising doubt that it's vacant. If they have a year-long window of time that they can create a semblance of logic that says that someone lived in it for one day as of in the last 365.
Would you like to tighten that, Senator Limmer?
I don't know how. I'm struggling with that. No, I don't want to tighten it.
So many days. It's so many consecutive days.
Anything else, members? I just... Senator Higgins, I think what counsel read in terms of the transfer of ownership doesn't feel quite right for me, and you should think about that. You know, the question about how long do you hold on to it, I think she suggests that we should let the court make that determination, but if there's already well, I'm okay with it. I mean, if they have 6 months to decide, I guess it's no nonprofit wants to become a
receivership landlord forever and ever. So, any other questions for Senator Higgins or the witness, Senator Neville?
Madam Chair, I apologize for getting here late. I was in another committee, but have we had the discussion on due process yet? I don't want to rehash everything, but I have some pretty grave concerns about having private entities come in and ultimately be able to take property away without any payment at all. There's nothing in here that says that the owner of the property gets paid anything. Basically, you come in and if he doesn't reclaim it after some improvements have been done, he loses it. And every property, I suppose it's possible for some to be in such bad condition that the cost to tear the house down might exceed the lot. But otherwise, I mean, the vast majority of properties have some value. And, you know, so generally, when we're going to allow taking, there's got to be some public purpose. And I suppose, I mean, if the government were doing it, you're putting it in Chapter 463, which is the hazardous property statute, which is that's the place it should be. If you've got a hazardous property, the government, the city, or the county can go in and put them on notice and clean it up or condemn it if the fix-up doesn't happen. But here you're letting private properties do it, private owners do it, and then you're even trying to say on the bottom of page 2 that if you appoint one of these nonprofits, that the temporary possession of the property doesn't constitute a taking. Well, how can that be? How can we have inverse condemnation cases where regulations alone constitute a taking. You know, and now we're saying you're going to lose possession, and in the next section you say they can collect rents and evict tenants. So if it's if it's good enough condition that they can collect rents and evict people, it's got to be worth something, and the possession of it has to constitute a taking, it strikes me. And so I'm just wondering, how do we get around the due process arguments here that you can't take somebody's property without due process, which in most cases for condemnation means there's got to be a public purpose, and you got to figure out what the value of the property is before you take anything of it. Even if it's only a temporary taking, you have to pay something for that, it seems. But the more fundamental issue is we're letting private entities now do it. I mean, if this issue is more important in the Twin Cities than it is in Greater Minnesota, then why doesn't the city of Minneapolis step up to the plate and have a department that goes out and actively and aggressively condemns hazardous properties, and takes the title and pays compensation if there's a value to it, gets an appraisal done, and then turn it over to a nonprofit? Didn't we just have a bill like that this morning, I think? Oh, Senator Bergman's amendment was to turn the property over to a nonprofit then at the same price that you get it for. So, I mean, isn't that the way we should be trying to deal with this issue?
Senator Higgins.
Minneapolis does have a unit just like that, a problem properties unit.
Yeah.
And it's part of the inspections, regulatory services. And, yes, our inspectors go out and they look at those properties, and when it's appropriate, they condemn them. When it's appropriate, they get them boarded. And what the unit has found is that in many cases those owners have just plain walked away from those houses. There will be houses where people will try to come in and rehab them where they can't find the owner. You know, they aren't paying taxes, they aren't paying their water bill, they aren't paying a property manager, they aren't clearing the sidewalk in the winter, they aren't mowing the grass in the summer. They've just walked away. Now, in my book, I'm sorry, but they are now taking away from the community, and their property will have value only if somebody else gets it in their hand.
Well, Madam Chair,
Senator Neville,
Senator Hingle, I'm sympathetic to the problem, but the solution is that you declare it a hazardous property, and then so do it, and then you go
but
in.
They don't buy it. We have no mechanism to.
The current, I've used this statute at least once. I condemned an alcohol plant. And It was a pretty old, decrepit place. But what you can do, as I understand it under this statute, is you can go in, you can get a court order. If the owner just ignores the whole thing, you can board it up. You can secure it.
Yes.
And ultimately, you can condemn it.
Yes.
And then the public owns it.
No. That's the piece that's wrong.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, when the building is condemned, this the public doesn't own it. The owner still owns it.
Under your bill.
No. The way...
You can begin condemnation.
If your house is condemned, it just means that it's unfit for human habitation.
Well, we're talking two different kinds. I'm talking eminent domain. Under the hazardous property statute, double check. Senate Council, can't you exercise eminent domain?
You can, but didn't we make it like really hard last year? It seems to me we all were around this
My point is that if you serve the owner and he defaults and doesn't show up, the next step is to begin eminent domain proceedings under, I think, 117. Am I right or not?
Madam Chair, Senator, no.
Ms. Pontius?
Under 117, there's the provisions where you can condemn property for economic development purposes, and then there's the special rules governing blighted areas, which have to have a certain percentage of the area containing substandard housing or substandard buildings in it.
But the difference, Madam Chair, Senator...
Senator Higgins.
...is that this is not putting the onus on the local government, because those local governments don't have any more money to do anything than anybody else. This is a chance to get the churches and the nonprofits to get involved in the rehab of those communities.
Senator Higgins, presuming that there's still a mortgage on the property, and at the petition for the transfer of ownership, if the judge orders that transfer of ownership, I'm assuming that the nonprofit then would either take over that mortgage or they would pay off that mortgage and get a different loan for that, right?
Yes.
And then in the instance where there is no mortgage, let's say the owner owns that structure free and clear, and there is no mortgage, then the nonprofit would just take over ownership free and clear. And so there wouldn't be an appraisal ordered to at least give some kind of compensation to the owner? Senator Higgins? Mr. DiStefano?
Yeah, there is. It's in the hearing. The court is to look at the fair market value of the property, the cost of the rehab, and so the owner would be compensated by the court. And I'm looking at subdivision 2 on the hearing part. Yeah, I think that's it.
Where are you reading from, Mr. DiStefano?
Section 6, I'm sorry, starting at 4.25, page 3 of 4 on the one I have. So starting at 4.25 where the court... The court, in determining the proper compensation to the organization, may consider the income of the recipients received the property, the increase in the fair market value of the property resulting from the rehab by the organization. So the owner is getting paid in that case.
Well, that's in the court in determining the proper compensation for the organization in the instance when the owner shows up to say, you've done all the fixings, you now have a tenant in it, everything is running well, now I want my property back. The court then can look at all of that and say, well, my understanding is okay, well, fork over XYZ amount to the nonprofit organization and we'll restore you to full ownership of your property. I'm assuming that if the owner can't pay up that amount, then the owner wouldn't be able to redeem the property or wouldn't take back possession, so then the nonprofit would still have it. And after 6 months, the nonprofit then could petition the court then for transfer of ownership. And in that process, when the nonprofit petitions the court for transfer of ownership, and the owner shows up and says, I didn't have the money to pay them for the repairs that they did up front, and so I just let them kind of run it. But now at 6 months, they want to transfer ownership. Well, that house belonged to my great-great-grandma. There's no mortgage on it. And if they're going to do that, I'd like some of the equity that's in the house, even if it's $25,000, $30,000. There isn't a provision in here to say that the court would have to order an appraisal of some sort. I mean, in the instance where there's a mortgage, you can say, fair and square, we're taking on the liability for the mortgage, you Mr. Bad Investor, you. But what if it's an instance where the owner owns it free and clear, then you can't say that.
I thought it said an increase in the fair market value of 4.31 through 4.32. That's how you'd have to determine it. It's right in the statute. I guess that's where I'm reading it.
And if the and as you were saying, if the owner couldn't come up with the money to pay it off right there, it would become a lien on the property. You know, then they would have a chance to pay it back as other liens on the property.
Madam Chair.
Senator Neville.
I mean, I think your observation is correct. There isn't anything in this bill that talks about the owner being paid anything in exchange for taking his property. Everything that's in this bill talks about how much the owner has to pay back in order to keep it. And, you know, there's another part that I think is problematic, and that's it contemplates, it seems, that the nonprofit will start making repairs and improvements to the property before...
During temporary ownership.
Yeah, during the 6 months. And there's a language in it that says they then have... an encumbrance on the property for the money they spend, and it's a first lien on the property. Well, what if there already is a mortgage on the property? I mean, we can't just jump this one to first if there's another one already there. So that's problematic. That would constitute arguably a taking of the interest that the first mortgage company has. So, I mean, it just strikes me, Senator Higgins, the way to deal with this is to work through the governmental unit, not to bring the nonprofits in. Yeah, maybe the governmental unit, after they get the proper court order and prove the public purpose of the cleanup under the hazardous property law, can contract then with some nonprofit. But after, you know, at some point, I do believe that the current law, if the owner takes no action, the current law would allow the city or the county to condemn the property and take the title to it. Then once the title is in the government's name, and arguably, you know, they've gone through the condemnation and they've gotten an appraisal and paid, if anything, what they should, then they can give it to whoever they want. They can give it to a nonprofit to clean up or do whatever they want. But that's the way, I mean, I think that this bill would be quickly challenged in court if we pass it this way.
Madam Chair, Senator, actually the other states have done this, and I explained the importance of the priority lien to you. The city of Baltimore has a huge vacant building problem, bigger than ours, but it's growing to be that way. State of Ohio, Illinois, California all have bills on the books just like this. They pass constitutional muster. Why it's not a taking, as you know, under the Lucas case in the U.S. Supreme Court, you can only take if there's a legitimate property interest. Now, the legislator in the state has police powers to protect their citizens. It's considered an exception to the Constitution on taking if the state uses its police powers to cure a nuisance. And you have to take a legitimate property right, and it's no owner's right to have a property that's a nuisance. It's vacant, you know, no one's lived there in a year, people are selling crack, stuff like that out of it. The lien provision, in the other states, they've all passed constitutional muster. They've defeated these arguments in court. The lien part is the key. So let's say you don't have a priority lien. What you have three fact patterns that are kind of running through our communities right now. You have the equity strippers that have come in, and you get a situation where the fair market value of the property, it's actually less than the mortgage, and they've just walked away. There was really no intent of renting it out and whatnot. They just kind of took the equity out of the property. The second fact pattern you have is a speculative investor. They purchased properties throughout the city, and so they bet wrong in a couple parts of the city where the properties went down. And similarly, the fair market value is less than the mortgage is. And in both those cases, The owner's not getting anything anyway. There's nothing to take because there's no equity. However, what the lien allows you to do is now there's an incentive for the mortgage companies to reinvest back into the property because they're going to be paid back first. Now, let me give you a fact pattern that's going to happen a lot. You're going to have a building that has $250,000 in mortgages on it, might be worth $150,000. And let's say it's not fixed up, but say it gets torn down. You're going to have the first mortgage company might not get hardly anything. They might get the fair market value of the property. You get the second mortgage company that's going to get nothing. If it's fixed up, what happens is the first lien holder does have a priority lien. They get paid. But at least the second mortgage company is made whole. And a very good likelihood the third mortgage company, the second mortgage in this that fact pattern, would actually get something. And the reason why there's really no tool right now to fight the vacant problem. And I know you're late, but I was explaining in the month of November, there was about 800 vacant properties in St. Paul. Now, I was in court yesterday talking to the city attorney. There's between 1,000 and 1,200. And the reason why you have that problem is you got really no tool to deal with it. Finally, you have a tool. The statute is a good tool to deal with it. And it is kind of a mirror image of other states that have used it successfully to fight the vacant building problem. On the due process, I look at due process different than you do. Due process is notice. Due process is notice to the owners and receiver. And when you look at the statute, it does even give banks additional rights to come in and rehab the building. They have rights to come in and fix the building as well. So it does take care of that as well.
Senator Neville.
Banks don't have the right to come in and do it unless it's in their mortgage. If they have a contract, if a person has signed a mortgage and they have the right to go into court and get a receiver appointed, then they can take possession pursuant to the contract. It's a mortgage where the guy conveyed it to him. But otherwise, I'm not aware of anything that gives a bank the right to just unilaterally come in and start making improvements or fixing. But I guess, like I said, I don't deny that there's a problem in Minneapolis. It's probably a huge one. But we still have to follow. I mean, my concept of due process is very well understood by me. It differs, I guess, from yours. And so what I would like you to do is educate me if I'm wrong. You get me that statute from Baltimore or wherever you want and the court decisions that have upheld it. And I'll study them as carefully as I can. But, I know that this U.S. Supreme Court case was it Lucas? Was that the name?
It's Lucas.
Yeah, the Lucas case. I mean, that's why we did our eminent domain things last year. But it did say that the government could take property for economic development. That would be considered a public purpose. And we responded by that by changing our statutes and saying we're not going to allow that unless it's blighted and some other things. But even then, the government is the one that still has to take it. We don't allow private parties to go in and just directly take property. And this bill here, it just skips the government in the middle. The government doesn't have to be involved at all. It just allows a nonprofit or a church to come and do it. That's really problematic from my point of view.
Mr. DiStefano, am I correct in saying that the Lucas case you're referring to with respect to this kind of legislation is different from the case that Senator Neville was referring to that led to the eminent domain issues?
It's the same case.
Last year. It's the same case?
Mm-hmm. Maybe it's not. Lucas, was it South Carolina?
I believe that the eminent domain case is the Kelo case, isn't it?
Kelo. It was Kelo. Kelo.
New Haven. Lucas is a U.S. Supreme Court case out of, I believe, South Carolina. Right. It's the leading case on police powers, nuisance properties, and takings.
Why don't you get that information to members of the committee on that case? Senator Higgins, I think that to address the point that I raised earlier and maybe some of Senator Neville's concern about compensation, we might want to put in here somewhere, and I'm not going to ask you to do it today. But we might want to put in here somewhere that perhaps at the time when the court orders the temporary possession, that some kind of appraisal process gets put in place to establish what the base value of that property is at that time.
And then at the time when there is a petition or when the owner comes back and asks for that property to get back, then the court could properly make a determination based on what the appraisal was when the nonprofit took over and how much, you know, and then would do another appraisal to see what that added value is and what the nonprofit is owed. Or at the time, if there's a petition for transfer of ownership, and let's say there is no mortgage, that at least in that instance, once the expenses are paid off, that the owner at least gets something for their property if there's no mortgage. And do visit with Senator Neville to make sure that he has seen that. Any further questions for Senator Higgins? Senator, is there anybody else here in the audience who would like to testify either for or against this bill as amended?
Madam Chair.
Senator Lummer.
Did we ever get to the definition of blight yet? I've raised it a couple times, and that really is key to whether or not the property is a nuisance.
Well, we just have to, Senator Lummer, we'll just have to do a cross-reference to the blight definition in the eminent domain law. Can you, Ms. Pontius?
Yeah, members, there's some different definitions. The eminent domain law defines blighted area, and then and in turn uses a definition of structurally substandard, which is somewhat complex in terms of it basically have to have building code violations and they have to have citations and different steps they have to go through. There's also a definition of blight for purposes of the economic development statute, which may be more along the lines of what you're looking for. But if I can kind of put together some of the examples if you want.
This is pretty serious action when government recognizes a nonprofit to independently go out and take someone's house. And I think we need to have proper definitions before we go down that path. Now, there are methods for government to do that, and as Senator Neville pointed out, there is a little bit of a discomfort allowing a nonprofit to do it. There certainly would be their own incentive to do that, and I get a little concerned when a bill like this comes before us and we don't have definitions that trigger action to take someone's property, and it's not defined. And to vote on this in the hope that we get the definition somewhere in the future, even though that's our job on committee, I'm a little uncomfortable with that.
Senator Lummer, I'm not suggesting that. I'm asking Ms. Pontius.
The bill on the table?
I'm asking Ms. Pontius if we can make a cross-reference on some other area, and that's why she's making those cross-references so that the committee can decide which cross-reference it would like to use. Which cross-reference, Senator Lummer, would you like to use?
Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, you've asked for a half a dozen different things for us to bring back, and so I'm wondering whether we shouldn't just lay this on the table until another day when we can bring back the pieces that people need for some more information.
Your decision, Senator Higgins.
I know Senator Lummer doesn't, he wants more definition on blight. Senator Neville's got, the Lucas decision he wants to look at. So if you could put us on for another day real soon, I think we can come back with some more information.
I can't promise that, Senator Higgins. We've got a really, really full load. And I think that we either try to resolve this and we send you somewhere else. I think you go to the floor, and between now and the floor, we can work that out if that's what this committee decides.
Madam Chair, if I can take a motion to lay a bill on the table with debate.
Senator Orman, I didn't hear Senator Higgins make that motion.
She suggested. Madam Chair, how many more hearings are you contemplating having for this committee? I know that your agenda is full. Because a lot of committee bills come here second or third or fourth.
We're probably double shifting next Thursday. And then we have a number of other policy bills that we have to get to. So.
Well, then, how about if I commit to talk to both Senator Neville and Senator Limmer? Mr. Stefano, will get the Supreme Court case and the other things that Senator Neville asked for, and we'll get that all resolved before I even attempt to take it up on the floor if the committee votes to send it out of here.
Senator Orman.
Madam Chair, I think that it's premature to send this bill with so many significant issues in it, and I respect what Senator Higgins is trying to do here, but I think we should look at this bill again before it goes to the floor. It's in everyone's best interest to do that, and so I would move at this time to lay this bill on the table.
Senator Orman moves that Senate File 308 be laid on the table. Any discussions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say nay. Motion passes. Senator Olson, Senate File 795. Thank you, Madam Chair. Before we begin, I have a delete all amendment, and then I have some oral amendments to the delete all amendment as well. It's the A1 amendment. Senator Olson, hang on a second so that we get all the amendments in the packet. All right. Senator Olson, why don't you do the amendment to the amendments to the amendment?
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. On line 10, after the word but, delete it and insert is. Mm-hmm. On line 11, after the semicolon, insert county. And after protection, insert services. On line 13, delete the comma and the word guardians. And on line 17, after range, insert of.
Those are generally grammatical corrections.
Yes.
Senator Betzel. Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, I do have a question. On line 10, it refers to probate courts, and technically we don't have probate courts anymore, but I don't know whether that would be, you know, I don't know the proper term right now. They're all district courts, and some have jurisdiction and some have separate probate jurisdiction divisions and some do not. So, but probate court used to be a separate entity within the state. So,
just say courts.
No, it's courts. I'm sure that the court will send somebody with expertise in this area. They're not going to send somebody who knows nothing about it. So,
Senator Olson, can we just say, can we delete probate?
That would be fine, Madam Chair. We could just say the probate division of the district court.
Yeah, or
Senator Neville, do you have an opinion on that?
I think you're right.
Okay. Yeah. Probate division of the district court.
And Madam Chair?
So between probate and court, insert division of the. Senator Higgins.
District.
Of the district.
The district.
And then, Madam Chair, on the next line, why do we spell out in the metropolitan area and greater Minnesota? I mean, that's kind of Minnesota. So I think we should delete that phrase. And then we need to delete the colon on line 1.10 because it's just kind of random.
Thank you, Senator Higgins. The reason, Madam Chair?
Senator Olson.
The reason for differentiating between the metropolitan area and greater Minnesota was only to make certain that we had representation from both areas rather than just representation from one or the other.
And possibly the word both in both the metropolitan area and greater Minnesota?
That would be a wise amendment. That would be better, Senator Higgins.
Between in and the on line 11, insert both. And then you still want that semicolon?
No, the colon.
The colon, delete it?
That would be correct, Madam Chair.
Anything else, members?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I apologize. We got this together in a hurry, and I appreciate your patience.
On the grammatical amendments to the A1 amendment, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion passes. Now, on the A1 amendment, as amended, to put the bill in the shape that the authors would like it to be in. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion passes. Now, Senator Olson, on the study.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 795 deals with guardians and conservatives who are appointed by the court to make personal and financial decisions for Minnesotans deemed incapacitated by a serious mental illness, a traumatic brain injury, or other impairment. These are some of the most vulnerable people in our society. The vast majority of guardians and conservatives are conscientious professionals who do provide this service often for very little pay. But because they have such broad decision-making authority over their wards, there are inevitable cases of abuse and neglect. The real problem is there is almost no oversight over their behavior. Abuse can last for months or years without anyone knowing. Senate File 795 originally sought to increase oversight over guardians and conservators, but as this bill progressed, it became apparent that this issue affects a myriad of stakeholders and therefore needs further study. The delete all amendment just adopted would enable that study. We know of no opposition from the advocacy community and would appreciate your support. With me today to talk for a moment about the bill is Will Wilson from the Mental Health Association.
Mr. Wilson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Will Wilson from the Mental Health Association. We advocate for individuals with mental illnesses with an emphasis on protecting their rights. I wanted to briefly give you an example of a case that our office worked on recently over the last couple of years. John Doe is a young adult who has serious mental illness. About 5 years ago, he was deemed incapacitated by a court because of his mental illness and because his family could not provide for his needs. The courts appointed a guardian for him. And very shortly after that, John started noticing some problems. No longer had access to members of his own family, and the guardian was sort of a gatekeeper as to who he could see and who he could not see. And then very seriously what ended up happening is that the guardian actually said that she understood what was best for him, even above the advice from his own doctor. John called our office, and we started about a two-year process of getting his guardianship changed and removed. Eventually, the guardian did resign, and the reason that she gave was actually because she thought she was entitled to legal expenses in fighting what the family actually wanted. Ultimately, John was given a new guardian, and I'm happy to report that after about a year with the new guardian, he was granted full capacity. He's working, living at home, and managing his mental illness. As Senator Olson mentioned, this is an issue that branches out all over the place, and there are a lot of different stakeholders that have an interest in this, and we do feel that we need to study it a little bit more before coming forward with a proposal to add some oversight to what guardians do. Thank you.
Senator Olson, this commits the court to a study. Is there going to, and I don't see any appropriation request in here, is there going to need to be an appropriation, and have you spoken with the courts? Are they all right with convening this study group? Mr. Wilson.
Madam Chair, when we heard this in the House, The chair.
The other body.
The other body, sorry.
Yes.
When we heard this in the other body, the chair mentioned that he had spoken to the Supreme Court and that they had decided that they would go ahead and do this. We have not heard from the administrator's office whether or not this would have a cost. If it did, we think it would be nominal.
That's of concern to me. Were you able to, that's all you heard, but you weren't able to get any confirmation from the courts?
No, Madam Chair, no.
Senator Betzold.
If this were sent to the Finance Committee, a fiscal note could be generated and determine whether there'd be in per diem costs, any court costs and so forth. I think that's appropriate. I don't think we can just assume there are no costs when you're creating something like this, because there are costs. Whether they come out of the agency's budget or not remains to be determined. But I think that, you know, the prudent thing would be to do if the committee decides to approve this is to send it to the Finance Committee.
And Madam Chair and Senator Betzold, I would agree with Senator Betzold, and I would also say that if it makes this committee more comfortable, I can, before the Finance Committee hears this, I can solicit a letter of support from the courts. I do believe that the courts, but again, this is my personal opinion, but there's a lot of time and money spent by the courts in dealing with problems that arise with guardians and conservatives when they're not perhaps correctly trained or certified, as this bill would propose to do, or when other problems arise, sometimes with misappropriations of funds and so forth, and that's the type of thing this is meant to address. So I can see why the courts would want to support it, but I'd be happy to attempt to get a letter like that, so that by the time it gets to finance, there might be
very good
more comfort.
Any further questions for Senator Olson?
Well, Madam Chair,
Senator Betzold.
Let me just give an observation, because over the years, there have been a number of high profile cases involving some guardianships or conservatorships, including one involved a judge who was embezzling from it. And there always seems to be a number of bills generated as a result of them. And I think the conclusion we've come to over the years is that if the courts had sufficient resources, money, to hire, you know, teams of auditors, teams of field workers, and so forth, they could check up on these cases, but they don't. And so what winds up happening is the judge basically signs an order, off people go, and there have been a number of abuses simply because there is no way to monitor them. And I just have a hunch that in the end they're going to come back and say, well, you know, give us some money, we can watch these things and make sure these things don't happen. Short of that, I'm not quite sure, what the recommendation, meaningful recommendations can be, but we'll be interested in seeing what they say.
Senator Olson.
And Madam Chair, the original bill basically was for the ombudsman to have authority over complaints, and also for there to have to be a certification process, but then we got into discussions about, you know, family members versus people who do this professionally, and so that's why there was a determination that we should look at this more carefully to try to make sure that we had everyone on board with the proposal that we'd bring forward.
You're good. Senator Neville, did you have a question?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, the study is pretty much of a blank slate. Is there a particular area that you want them to study, or you want them to study the whole system? Because the way it's written, it seems like it's just about the whole system, and that would be to come back with a report that had some significance to it. Probably would take some money and a fair bit of time. I mean, I've served on a few of these studies, and probably the first thing they're going to look at when they see this language is, man, we can't do that in just a few meetings. But if there's a particular problem or issue that you want them to study, maybe we should actually say that with more specificity in this language.
Senator Olson.
Well, Madam Chair, I guess I would leave it into the experience of this committee, who's maybe looked at these issues, as Senator Betzold said, longer before. The original proposal was for a couple specific things that were identified as something with relatively low cost that could put some restraints on the system, and that was to bring them within the supervision of the ombudsman and also for the certification. But it led to bigger questions and bigger problems and some of the same concerns. So if we could have a study that would look at this more generally, or we could limit it to some those specific things that were proposed in the original legislation, and I guess I would leave it to the guidance of this committee to suggest what the best direction would be.
Senator Neville.
Well, Madam Chair, so if I understood what you said, what you really want them to do is to study whether or not, study the feasibility of creating an ombudsman for guardianship and conservator situations, or something else?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Wilson.
Senator Neville, one of the reasons this is so broad is because there have been some studies that have been done already over the last few years on this. And the idea, we came up with this language in a meeting that we actually had with MAGIC, the Minnesota Association of Guardians and Conservators. And they wanted to bring in some of the existing studies that have been done. I believe there's one from Ramsey County. The courts did one recently. And also, I think Hennepin County might have done one also. And they did talk about some of these things, like the rights of wards and protected persons and complaint processes. And so I think that's why it's so broad. I understand your point. It's something that we wanted to allow this study group to incorporate outside ideas that have already been.
Senator Foley.
I think that, Madam Chair, that if we were to look at that as a meta study and they merely studied the records and didn't convene all of these people, you could get by without any cost. But if this were to go in with all of these names and so forth, we're already underfunded in my division, and it just there's nothing there. So you're going to have to tell me where you're going to get the money if you're going to bring it through.
Senator Foley, I would assume that even if there's a cost to it, the court might perhaps come forward and say whatever cost there is, if it's minimal enough, we'll just eat the cost. That would be the only way, now that your budget is finished, that this could, you know, move forward. So,
Madam Chair, unfortunately, it come back and you're going to cut more out of it. So it's I think this idea is great, but the fact is that that you'd have to narrow it down enough so there isn't any cost. And I think the author probably can do that all right, and we would not want to see it in those circumstances.
Well, Senator Foley, I had asked my staff to contact the courts to see if somebody could be here to respond to this, and they must be tied up elsewhere because I don't see them here.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
If the committee likes the concept of this bill, what I would suggest we might do is seek that letter from the courts before it gets to Senator Foley's committee with a statement regarding their feeling about costs, whether they're willing to absorb it or whether they would prefer not to have the study done if they were going to have to absorb the cost.
I agree with Senator Olson. I mean, I think within our jurisdiction is to determine whether or not this is a good idea. I think that the cost is an issue. Once we send this to the Finance Committee, they could determine whether it could go forward or not based on the cost. We don't have a cost estimate, and I would hate to let a good idea stop here if we don't have a good idea of what that cost is. Presumably, if it doesn't cost anything, or if the cost is minimal enough that it could go forward, you know, we should let that cost be determined so that it is known in the Finance Committee. So, Senator Betzel.
Well, Madam Chair, I don't know that we need legislation to have this work done, because, you know, these organizations exist. They could probably meet. You know, there's plenty of organizations that go on, study things and like that. If they're looking for some impetus, that's fine. But I agree that you can't have this kind of a laundry list in here and say, go study these things, keep it cheap, and get back and be thorough, because it isn't going to happen. Now, perhaps we could say instead of on line 5, regarding the following areas, we strike the words the following, and then on line 6, after conservatorship, include the words which may include. So they would make recommendations to the legislature regarding areas of conservatorship regarding which may include, and then you have a list there. So as Senator Neville indicated, maybe they could get together, say, wow, we can't do all this stuff, but, hey, here's three things we could probably come up with, and they come back next year, give us three things, and say, now let us keep studying, and, you know, maybe we could do that. But I think it's doomed to failure if we send out this list as is and say, get back to us on all of them, because I don't see how it's going to happen.
Senator Olson?
Madam Chair, I would be very happy to accept that amendment. I think that's a wise suggestion.
Madam Chair, then I'll move on page 1, line 5, strike the word... Perhaps counsel might find a slightly better way to do this. Strike the words, the following. And in line 6, after guardianship, but before the hated semicolon, okay, add which may include.
Then the colon comes out.
Yes. Then the colon comes out. The hated colon comes out.
I like them just fine when they're correct. I like them when they're...
On Senator Bitzel's motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposing say nay. Motion passes.
We need to have a class. Good.
Yes, I should.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, I'd then like to move that Senate File 795 be recommended to pass and re-referred to Finance.
On Senator Olson's motion for Senate 795 as amended. Any further discussions? Senator Neville.
I just want to add a comment that I've got a bill in that deals with powers of attorney. There's a lot of questions of misuse of powers of attorney, and maybe in some ways more so because there's no court supervision at all for that, like it is for conservatorships and guardianships. And but I think to suggest adding that to your bill would make it really broad. So, but we should be aware that there are lots of ways that fiduciaries can take advantage. And I'm not so sure if the power of attorney one might not be just about as bad as the conservatorship one.
Anybody in the audience want to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, on Senator Olson's motion, all those...
Someone did raise her hand.
No?
I think this was a witness in favor, so if the committee would like to hear from her, but okay.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion passes.
This is to finance, right?
Yeah. To finance. Senator Olson, Senate File 215.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have some letters from a constituent. I'd appreciate it if I could have these passed out, which explain the reason for Senate File 215. Basically, Senate File 215 originated at the request of a constituent who's been working with the representative in the other body. And this is a bill that would extend jurisdiction of the court for habitual truants through age 19. At the present time, we have jurisdiction over other types of offenses and issues through age 19, but statute specifically includes truancy in terms of the court's jurisdiction. And this was requested by a social worker in Cass County who believes that he would be able to keep children, young adults, in school longer if we were to extend jurisdiction. And obviously, the first part of this letter gives a lot of information about how much better off young people are if they end up with a high school education. And I don't think any of us really dispute that. I guess the question for this committee is whether we feel it's appropriate to allow the courts to maintain jurisdiction through age 19 when we don't have a requirement that someone has to stay in school through age 19. So this would obviously only come into play when someone before they were 18 had already been adjudicated a truant but then would allow the courts to continue their jurisdiction through age 19.
Any questions for Senator Olson? Senator Betzel.
Senator Olson, could you maybe elaborate? And I'm trying to read through the letter as quickly as I can. It's hard to read the bill, listen to testimony, and read at the same time. But I think that is a fairly good point, though, that if we can't mandate a student stay in school past the student's 18th birthday, how can we then declare them to be a truant past the 18th birthday? I meant to understand that part.
Well, Senator Olson. And Senator Betzel, I understand that concern with the bill. There would have to be, it would have to be a situation where the person was, and as this person points out on page 2, they would also like us to look at amending the requirement that someone stays in school through only age 18. I'm not really sure that we can do that without really a major, since at the age of 18 we allow people to make most adult related decisions, even though I think this bill is very well intended. But we could, we have other situations, for example, when someone runs away from home, we can maintain jurisdiction over them through age 19 if the offense was committed before they reached age 18, even though obviously at age 18 they can leave home. And so there is some precedent for allowing this type of thing, for example, in the case of a runaway. But it would be, you know, it's a well intended desire to keep keep young adults in school longer, but it would it does have the other side of the argument being we're treating those persons who had already been truant before they were age 18 differently than someone who reaches 18 and then just decides to leave school.
Senator Betzel.
Senator Neville, I voted with you on the body piercing thing, so do you want to remind us of some of the laws that we have on the books here? I mean, I have some questions. I mean, if a person can get married, and I don't know. It's just, it raises a bunch of questions here. So.
Senator Higgins.
Senator, I thought we only required kids to stay in school until they were 16.
Senator Olson.
Senator Higgins, between 16 and 18, they have to jump through a couple of hoops in order to leave school. They can leave school, but they have to, the student and the parent have to attend a meeting with school personnel to discuss why it's a good idea to stay in school, basically, and then sign a written election to withdraw from school. So, and that requires the parent to do the same thing. So this would be in a situation, I guess, with where the parent wanted the child to remain in school and the child was just skipping school against their parents' wishes.
Senator Neville and Senator Betzel, in lines 112, talks about the fact that if the court determines it to be in the best interest of the individual to do so, does that give you sufficient comfort that this is going through the court process?
Madam Chair, I don't know the whole context for this section of law, but where the court continues jurisdiction over a juvenile to the age of 19 if it's in the best interest. But I think that that's different from the section that they're trying to exempt him on truancy. And I think truancy, you know, is a separate issue, and that's why I have some concerns about, again, if we can't require the student to stay in the school after age 18, how can we say, but you're going to be truant after the 18th? I don't know how the two work. And as Senator Olson indicated, we could probably have a bill that required the student to stay in school until 19 and then also, repeal that. But I think that would really make a huge issue, and I think that this sticks the nose into the tent.
Senator Neville.
That was my thought too. Does this apply to just juvenile delinquencies then? All of the juvenile delinquencies, including status offenses?
Ms. Pondius?
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, I'd have to double check that. I think it does, but.
Madam Chair?
Senator Olson.
Yeah, I think we already have in law the only exception is truancy for the continuation of jurisdiction.
The other
Right.
We can take to 19.
There's just a specific language accepting truancy. Otherwise, we can. And basically, this request came from a social worker, and the idea is someone trying to help that. You know, again, I think it's very well intended, trying to help that person through through obtaining an education in situations where the parent doesn't want the child dropping out of school. But once again, at age 18, there is that differentiation between the parent's wishes having anything to do with it anymore. So, but this is a situation because of the degree of problem that we've had in the Cass County area with the number of students who are leaving school prematurely and the ability of the strong feeling of this particular social worker that if we had legislation like this, we would have more children that he'd be able to, or more young adults we'd be able to graduate from law school by maintaining the availability of social workers and other court services for that person. And again, I think there is some court discretion built into the language of the bill.
Well, any further discussions or any more suggestions to Senator Olson?
What do you think?
Just another comment. Speaking when all my kids turned 18, you know, once they turn 18, even if they're still in high school, their parents can't see the grades. They can't. I mean, basically, they've got to sign authorizations, or we can't even get the report cards anymore. And yeah, once the kid turns 18, I think
it's true.
So, I mean, I'm just wondering, do we really want 18-year-olds in school who don't want to be there, no matter how good it might be for them?
Yes, no. Senator Higgins.
Senator Higgins.
The first year I was in the Senate, we had a bill that changed that, and I voted. Just as you said, if they don't want to be there, why should I got my handed to me at home from people who've been working for years and years and years trying to get kids to get to stay in school long enough to graduate and, you know, go on to bigger and better things. And, you know, it's a huge issue in my area as well as where Senator Olson lives. When the statistics in, you know, my part of the city are that less than half of the young African American boys in high school don't graduate. That's a heck of a problem, and I just see that there's such a huge. If you don't get your high school degree or your GED, what are you gonna do for the rest of your life? You know, so I think keeping them there, getting them.
Senator Olson.
And education is so important.
And Madam Chair, you know, I'll just say, having gone through four children of my own through this situation, my youngest daughter, who was here testifying last week, you could probably see was a fairly assertive young lady. I actually started her in school early. She was questionable which way to go, just so that I knew I could keep her in school through age 18, because I didn't know how she might be feeling about it 12 years later. A lot of kids turn 18 at an earlier and earlier point during their senior year of high school, because parents do tend to hold them back more now than they used to. And we know that decisions we make at age 18 are sometimes things that we would decide differently when we were older. I recognize and realize the legal difficulties with, you know, the maybe a little bit of inconsistency here, but to the extent that the court wants to be able to try to work with a particular family and a particular student to try to help keep that student involved in the school system so they can graduate, this bill would give them that opportunity.
Senator Olson, is it contemplated that perhaps those individuals would be ordered to go to, say, an alternative learning center and not necessarily be immersed back into the schools that they're currently at? I mean, I just have some concerns about, trying to, or in some way, when they don't want to, putting a 19-year-old back with, you know, a ninth grader who's only, you know, 14 or 15, or, I mean,
you know, we structurally, in trying to do well by our children, put them into institutional settings that sets them up for other things to happen. And that young man that we're trying to save, we make him come back to school, and he's 19 years old, and he strikes up a relationship with a ninth grader, and there we go. We've created a whole new different set of problems for him when they become intimate boyfriends and girlfriends. And I mean, it triggers a lot of statutory issues, too, in that instance. So I've always been a little bit concerned about having older students, you know, in high school at the same time with the younger students beyond where they have to be. Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, I think we have a bill around here this year. I know I'm getting quite a few letters about it to allow people older than age 21 to stay in high school, especially the the new Minnesotans
to 23
who haven't haven't had their entire education here in Minnesota. So.
Senator Foley.
Yeah, Madam Chair, the problem that I see is that you make laws like this, that if I were to go over to Minneapolis, I would find that a large number of folks there aren't enrolled in school and could have been charged even below the 18. And so looking at that, we get people coming into Anoka County and there's a curfew violation. If we bother to send them back, they don't do anything with them anyhow. And so it's not a you mentioned alternate learning centers. Now that is going on, and I think for the most part, those are pretty good.
Well, Senator Neville,
this is really for the court to decide.
This is a practical matter. What can a juvenile court do if they order a kid into school for 19 and the kid just says, well, I'm not going to do it anyway. It's a status offense. It's a juvenile petty offense. Is that what it is? I mean, what are you going to do? Order him out of his home and place him in a foster home? You can't do that. You can't put him in jail. You can't. There's really no consequence. And do we really want judges issuing orders where there's no meaningful consequence if they ignore them? Maybe so. I guess what I'm saying is this as a practical matter, is this something we should do, even if it is a good idea? I mean, we do want kids to finish school, and we do want them to get their diploma. But using the juvenile court to force that may be an exercise in futility.
Senator Olson.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Neville, I guess all I can say to that is the flip side of that coin is that it does give the courts the authority to at least try to stay involved in a young person's life if they choose. And the court has an array of things they can do as far as through social workers. And back in my district, we have truancy officers, you know, that go out and try to encourage students to go to school, sometimes provide transportation. There's a host of reasons sometimes why young people aren't in school. Sometimes it's just the fact that they don't have a way to get there in some rural communities. And so it does give the court the ability to use those tools when the court chooses to do that.
Well, Senator Olson, you've heard the feedback from the committee. Do you still wish for a vote on this, or do you want to think about it?
Well, it seems like we have a mixture here in terms of, and maybe I don't know how the committee would vote. Maybe they would. I don't have strong feelings on this one way or the other, but I think it's a well-intended bill. I don't know if there's a way to improve the intent, or maybe it's better just to get a vote up or down on it and then decide if we're going to spend any more time on it.
Senator Olson moves that Senate File 215 be recommended to pass and be sent to the Senate floor. Senator Ortman.
Is it a higher motion to move to lay the bill on the table?
Yes.
I believe it is.
That motion at this time.
Senator Ortman moves to lay Senate File 215 on the table. All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed say nay.
No.
Motion passes.
Do you want to pass it? Senator Ortman, did you want to work with me on this, or do you just not want to go to the
Senator Scheid.
Senator Schein, I...
Oh, no.
I'll
just make the motion.
I still think I should get my read on
her. Oh, Madam Chair.
Go through the torture.
Okay. Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, we...
How is it that one author can come into this committee with a one-page bill and with a 175-page bill?
Madam Chair, I was hoping you wouldn't notice.
I think if it's okay, Senator Scheid, and your witness can sit there. Can we take 792
first? Would you like to do the little one, the very technical one? I don't know.
I understand, Senator Scheid, that this is just language to update the statute to be consistent with the guardian law.
Right. And I mean, to be consistent with with the usage of the language. So it instead of saying, and this has to do with trust companies, and the law governing trust companies. And instead of using executor or administrator, we now will say conservator of the estate or personal representative of an estate.
Any questions for Senator Scheid?
It's from the bar. It's from the bar.
No, a few years ago, we changed the terminology that if it's a guardian, it's only guarding the person, and if it's a conservator, it's only conservator of the estate. So, I mean, those are the... Sorry. I'm still trying to find something. So.
Senator Batzold's picking on me.
No questions.
What's the definition of is?
Senator Scheid, what's your desire?
I'm sorry. I would move that Senate File 792 be recommended to pass.
Is this a consent?
Well, it really is, I think. But.
Senator Limmer, may this be a consent calendar item?
Yes, it may. I suggest that the committee consider that in the most benevolent.
On Senator Scheid's motion, Senate File 792 be recommended to pass and be placed on the consent calendar. Any further discussions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion passes.
Now let's get to the other one.
Madam Chair, members may or may not be aware that in just about 2 years ago now, Governor Pawlenty, this is regarding Senate Bill 998. Governor Pawlenty issued an order, reorganization order, bringing a number of professions within the jurisdiction of the Department of Labor and Industry. For example, Department of Administration, with Mr. Joachim was employed before, has Building Codes and Standards Division. That's been brought into Labor and Industry. Department of Health oversaw plumbing and engineering. Board of Electricity was unto itself, I think. The Department of Commerce regulated residential contractor licensing. Labor and Industry had the boiler and high-pressure piping units within it. And so now all of those have been brought into the Department of Labor and Industry with that order from 2 years ago, which we had a kind of a framework of a bill that we passed last year to keep that moving. And now this is more the detail, the substance of that. I think much of it is technical, but Mr. Joachim from the department will be here. By the way, we also added then, we brought into Labor and Industry the authority for promulgating the state fire code. And I think I will ask Mr. Joachim, do we have anything that tells us what part we're supposed to be looking at? That's what I hadn't seen, actually.
Senator Scheid,
in the enforcement, and I thought that was added to what it was, but...
Mr. Joachim, is it Joachim? I understand that what is before this committee is Section 8 of Article 2, all of Section 3 on enforcement, and Sections 27 and 29 of Article 8. So if you would... if you would just take us through those sections, that would be good.
Committee members, I'm Tom Joachim, Assistant Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Industry.
I'll give you a brief synopsis of how we got to this. Again, Senator Scheid talked about consolidation. What we are talking about today with the enforcement and a couple other pieces is we used each of the five agencies or groups that were consolidated. Each had enforcement tools within them, some of them different from each other. We took the plumbing model and used that as the base model and then tried to add in the best practices of the other ones, electrical and residential contractor licensing, to come up with a new enforcement tool section that would be applicable to all of them. So they all have the same criteria across the board when we get into these types of situations. And I need to address where this comes into play. The normal process for inspections is somebody takes out a permit. They call us for inspections, whether they're homeowner or the contractor. We go out and do the inspections. 85%+ of the time, they make the corrections, project moves on. 10% of the time, might take a second correction. 5% of the time, we get people that either say, I'm not going to make that correction, or I'm not going to follow that procedure. And that's when the enforcement tools come into play that we have, whether it's residential contractor licensing, high-pressure piping, boilers, plumbing, or electrical. Need some enforcement tools to take it when it gets to that step, kind of below the line application of enforcement. So this is what we're talking about. The first section on subpoenas is we have it in our workers' comp in the OSHA law that establishes that the commissioner or the commissioner staff is not subject to a subpoena if it relates to the licensing activity or the investigation that we have to perform. And we're concerned about that is we've had, and without that, we have, whether it's a building contractor or the homeowner, using us as the expert witness, verifying what we did for inspection. So we get called into kind of a double duty. We're testifying for the witness, and we're also testifying on what was found. We don't have a problem if we get called into court and a judge calls us in to testify, but we don't want to be the expert witness for the homeowner or the building contractor in that application. So that's why we're requesting to not have the subpoena requirements applicable to us during those types of investigations.
Mr. Joachim?
Yes.
Is this something that's new, or did you have this already under current law?
Madam Chair, committee members, this is something that's new in this department, the Safety Codes and Services Department. We have it in the OSHA law right now for OSHA applications and OSHA investigations.
Madam Chair? Can we ask as we go along?
Yes, that would be helpful.
I'm still not clear of the context in which these subpoenas are we talking administrative hearings, or are we talking actions in district court where there's maybe a lawsuit by a homeowner who hired a contractor and there's a disagreement over whether he complied with the code or not?
Mr. Joachim.
Madam Chair, I think I better bring up legal services to address that specific issue because they'll give us some more detail on this.
Madam Chair, sorry, Senator, I didn't see who
called.
Neville.
Sorry, your name is covered up. But the way that this would work is it's for purposes of private litigation, for where a homeowner may be suing a contractor or a contractor is suing a homeowner, and they want to subpoena in the department inspector to basically testify as an expert witness as to whether there was a code violation or some other aspect on the case. And what happens is, of course, then that inspector is not doing inspections for purposes of enforcement, you know, for the state. They're basically being compelled to use their time to be pulled into private litigation.
Also, could you state your name for the record?
Sorry, I'm Nancy Lepping, and I'm the Director of Legal Services for the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry. Excuse me, and it's L-E-P-P as in Paul, I-N-K.
Thank you. And Senator Neville.
When you say that the department is being held in, you're talking about the local building inspectors. Or you're talking about somebody who actually is with the state Department of Labor and Industry.
Ms. Lepping?
I'm talking about either an employee of the department or someone who's under contract with the employee of with the department as an as an inspector.
The reason I ask is, I mean, I didn't even know that the Department of Labor and Industry did building inspections and stuff. Mm-hmm. I guess I thought it was local inspectors. Oh, okay. So would this prevent a subpoena being issued not to provide an expert opinion, but just to provide
question, a fact, an observation. Did you see this?
Yes.
But that, why would we, I mean, in order to prove a case, wouldn't even the Department of Labor and Industry, shouldn't they be treated just like any other witness who made a factual observation? I'll tell you the context I'm asking it. And this doesn't cover the fire marshals, does it? This is just the building trades. Right. Okay. I mean, I've had cases where I've had to, I've wanted to take the deposition of fire marshals. And they say, I'm an expert witness. You got to pay the fee up front before I'll even come. I said, I don't care about your opinion. All I want to know about is, what did you see? What observations did you make when you were there? What pictures did you take? I want to see them. So, I mean, bringing that context over to yours, why wouldn't your employees be able to, if you can provide evidence, why shouldn't people be able to bring you into court?
Ms. LePage. Madam Chair, Senator, it's a matter of your decision as to how you want the state's resources to be spent. And if you think that it's the public policy decision to have state inspectors being subpoenaed into private litigation and not performing inspections, then that's a policy decision that you would need to make. So the agency, its a position is that there would be other fact witnesses who would be available, other experts who are available, and therefore the resources of the state should be spent on doing inspections and in the mandate of the legislature in terms of its enforcement authority.
Senator Neville. Question for me, and then I'll stop. But just as a matter of separation of powers, I mean, is there a precedent that if a court issues a subpoena, actually, I guess now lawyers can issue subpoenas. You don't even have to get a court to do it. But it's still technically a court request to come to court. Is there some precedent that we can say that just because you're a state employee, you can't be subpoenaed in just to testify to facts?
Ms. Lepink.
Madam Chair, Senator, the OSHA statute, which provides for the same no subpoena provision, was challenged and went to, I believe, the Minnesota Court of Appeals and was held to be constitutional. Yes, okay. It was challenged on substantive and procedural due process grounds, and the court said that it was within the legislature's purview to pass such a law.
Senator Neville.
This is my second request today for this, but I'd like to see that court decision. So if you have it or Senate counsel can get it, I'm kind of interested in why they didn't raise separation of powers.
I can send you the... Madam Chair, Senator, actually, we have requests for this opinion from all over the country because there are many states who would like to have similar protections for their state investigators. In fact, I just provided the statute and the opinion to the state of Iowa. Okay. So for purposes of their OSHA inspectors.
Okay.
So, but I'd be happy to. I'm not remembering off the top of my head right now what the name of the case is, but I'd be happy to get it to you.
Thank you.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, and just following up further with what Senator Neville said, no one likes to have to be subpoenaed to court, especially if they're not a private party, if they're working for a salary and it's going to be taken away from their other duties. But I think it's really important for our system of civil justice that people have access to those who are in the position to have the knowledge. That's why we allow our civil court system to have subpoena power generally. Doctors don't like to come in to testify when we have cases that are, you know, where we have injuries, and we accommodate them by taking their testimony usually where they are, but they're at least subject to the court's jurisdiction. There's no more reason that I can think of to put a fence around this type of inspector than there would be, say, to put a fence around a law enforcement inspector. And yet they're the people who are at the scene whose testimony is really needed if our civil justice system is going to work. And so I can understand that this is probably a big inconvenience and no one likes to have to be put in this position. But to say that we're going to insulate state employees and yet make private parties still subject to the subpoena power doesn't seem to me to be a fair balance, and I don't see any more reason to give them a pass than I would to give a pass to anyone else.
Mr. Joachim?
Madam Chair, would you like me to continue on?
Yes, please. Before you start, Mr. Joachim, I see Judge Knutson's in the room.
And Judge Jack.
Oh, yes. Hi. Judge Knutson, I'm still waiting for my booster seat.
I want to make sure that gets passed.
Please continue.
I'm starting with Article 3 on the enforcement section, Section 2, and I'm just going to briefly go over the five main orders that we are able to work with. First is a notice of violation. This does not carry any monetary penalty, but could require violation to be corrected. A person who receives a notice of violation has 10 days to request a reconsideration, and the commissioner needs to respond within 15 days, and you'll see that kind of makeup in all of these. We have administrative orders. This can require correction of violations, can require the regulated party to cease and desist from committing the violations, and can assess a penalty up to $10,000 per violation. All or part of the penalty can be forgivable if the regulated party corrects the violation or develops an acceptable correction plan. And again, there is an administrative procedure for days and turning around on the request for a visit before the commissioner. We also have injunctive relief where the commissioner can apply to district court to enjoin violations. We have a stop work order. This is where the commissioner or staff can issue a stop work order to make someone cease and desist from committing violations. If a condition on real property violates the applicable law, stop order to the owner or lessee of the property can require that the condition be corrected. Stop order cannot include any monetary penalty, and the person receiving order has, again, that certain time period to respond back. And our last piece that's within the enforcement tools that we think is there, it addresses licensing order. The commissioner can take action against a person's license, registration, certificate, or permit if the person violates the applicable law or engages in other conduct warranting licensing action, for example, submitting false information to the department, failing to cooperate in the commissioner's investigation. Possible licensing actions are denial, suspension, revocations, censure, or placement of limits or conditions on the credential. And again, there's a up to a $10,000 fine per violation and a time frame on the response time.
Mr. Jackham?
Yes.
Can you tell us which of the different penalties you've talked about so far are new creations under this new repositioning, and which are the same but just being exported over or imported into this law?
Madam Chair, committee members, I believe all of these are existing
in existence
penalties. We had different names in different groups. So we tried to consolidate and come up with a consistent name for all of this action in all of the groups.
Please continue.
Madam Chair, committee members. Section 3 describes how the penalty is calculated, when penalties are due, and what needs to be included in the administrative and licensing orders, and basically our procedures. Section 4 prohibits regulated parties from making false statements in the documents required by applicable law. Section 5 allows the state to recover certain litigation costs, and Section 6 requires the department to establish by rule procedures for responding to written complaints that allege violations of the applicable law.
And then, Ms. Joachim, let me ask you this. Given all the penalty provisions that are already in the books, what's the rationale behind the subdivision 16 of the misdemeanor penalties? We've got all these civil penalties already in the book. Why would we impose a criminal penalty? Ms. Lepping?
Madam Chair, these are not additional. They exist under current law. So the agency basically just didn't want to make the policy decision to get rid of them. But you're correct to the extent that you provide for civil penalties, and for some of the disciplines, there was no penalty authority, and they basically defaulted to the misdemeanor. So consequently, by providing for the civil penalty, there is you could make the argument it should just simply replace the default misdemeanor provision. There are some other provisions that also in existing law that provide for gross misdemeanor. I think that in the instances where they're present, we're talking about a little bit more egregious behavior, which might get the attention of a prosecutor, as opposed to simply just being a default remedy.
Well, I agree, members, and we should think about that from a policy standpoint, is that if we've got these civil penalties in place, why, and under its reorganization, if the civil penalties are adequate, I think that we should reconsider whether or not, I know it's an existing law, but that doesn't mean that we don't take the opportunity to do something good here. And with respect to Subdivision 16, particularly the definition of applicable law, which is on line 1519, the cross-reference back to applicable law seems pretty broad to me, Ms. Lepik. What do you think?
The applicable law is basically the various code provisions that are now under this division's purview. So it's just bringing them all the various references to the electrical, manufactured housing, residential contracting. So that's, instead of renaming them each time, we just defined it as applicable law.
So, Ms. Lepik, if this committee were to strike Subdivision 16, would that make a big difference in terms of the department's ability to impose penalties?
Chair, no, it would not, and furthermore, that up to $10,000 would far exceed a misdemeanor penalty anyway. That
Senator Betzel moves that Subdivision 16 from line 1518 to line 1519 be stricken. Any discussions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion passes. And let's see. In the same vein, Ms. Lepik, could we actually? Oh, we haven't gotten there yet. Let me see here. Well, I'll get to that. Any other discussions from members on Article 3? Because Mr. Joachim has gone completely through Article 3. Correct. All right. Well, let's get to Article 8. Subdivision section 27 and 29. Section 27 starts on page 131 of the bill, and it's a very short cross-reference, Mr. Joachim.
Yes.
Ms. Lepik.
I'm sorry.
Would you just speak to section 27 for the committee members' information?
This language is... Madam Chair, this language is in current law, and it, for purposes of the residential contracting license, this provision basically says that if the underlying conduct on which the conviction would be grounds for denial, censure, suspension, or revocation of a license, then the provisions of Chapter 364 don't apply. And the provisions of Chapter 364 go to the ability sort of for rehabilitation. And so consequently, that Chapter 364, in essence, says that if certain criteria are met, you can be found to have basically rehabilitated yourself, and you would have eligibility then for certain kinds of licensure. What this does is, it has, and current law does, is says those rehabilitation provisions in Chapter 364 do not apply under this circumstance for purposes of a residential contracting license. So I'm not sure when that provision was originally enacted, and so I'm not privy to the legislative history on it. But it is, this is not new language. This is just language that's been moved and consequently appears underlined.
Good. Any questions on Section 27? And then we'll move on to, if there are no questions, we'll move on to Section 29. And in part, I think we're interested in hearing about the commissioner's review process and the administrative hearing process. Is that correct, Ms. Pontius?
Oh, Madam Chair, with respect to Section 29?
Yes.
That was the gross misdemeanor penalty?
Oh, in the back.
Yeah.
Yes, I see that, in Subdivision 10. But, Ms. Lepin, can you walk us through the commissioner's review authority and then the administrative hearing? That's current law, too. Is that correct, or is that new?
Madam Chair, the whole way that the recovery fund will operate is new.
Okay. Please walk us through that.
Sure. Under current law, there's an individual who has had a problem with a residential contractor needs to initially go into court, either district court or conciliation court, and obtained a judgment. Then there's once they've obtained that judgment, then there's an application process over which currently there's district court review. And then in which, in fact, the department is more or less a party in some senses. The concern, and it's a very cumbersome process. It requires the homeowner to continue to retain an attorney, because, of course, it's a district court proceeding, in essence. And the district court then, in essence, approves the application of the homeowner. And then the process proceeds to go to the department to have a payout from the recovery fund. What this legislation will do is, once the homeowner has obtained their judgment in district court, then it's simply an application process with the department to obtain a recovery from the recovery fund. If the department and the homeowner can't reach agreement on what the payout should be from the recovery fund, then the homeowner would have an opportunity to request a contested a hearing before the Office of Administrative Hearings to then resolve the matter. And so consequently, what this does is it, first of all, eliminates the need. It simplifies the process, eliminates the need for the homeowner to arguably continue to have legal counsel, really, for an administrative application process. And furthermore, it allows the department to work, instead of kind of being a party to the case, it allows the department to sit down with the applicant. If there's problems with the application, they can work through them. They can reach an agreement, ideally, as to what should be paid if there's any kind of disagreement as to the amount claimed in the application. And then only, you know, sort of as a last resort, if the department and the homeowner can't reach agreement, then the matter would go to a contested case hearing. And the kind of things that people get into disagreement on is primarily what's recoverable from what kind of costs or expenses or damages are payable from the recovery fund to the homeowner. So oftentimes there needs to be clarification on the department's part with the homeowner as to what they can actually be compensated for from that fund. But beyond that, most of the time there is little dispute between the department and the homeowner as to what should be paid. So it's an attempt to very much simplify the homeowner's the hurdles the homeowner has to get over to be able to get access to this fund, the money in this fund.
So, Ms. Lepin, on page 136, subdivision 10, the criminal penalty that's imposed, this is a new section, so that's new language?
That's not new. Walk you through where that came from. Under current law, there's requirement that this is kind of a complicated section because the recovery fund and the residential contracting was intertwined in other licensing requirements of the Department of Commerce. And so in the process of drafting this bill, we had to parse out the portions of the bill that were, you know, we had to either copy and paste or cut and paste former responsibilities of the Department of Commerce and provide for that in the Department of Labor and Industry. So if you in the current recovery fund statute, which is 326.975, there is a provision that says that in addition to any other fees, each applicant for license under the Contractors Recovery Fund is created in the State Treasury and must be administered by the Commissioner in the manner and subject to all the requirements and limitations provided by Section 82.43. And then in 82.43 is contained a criminal penalty provision that says it shall be unlawful for any person or agent of any person to knowingly file with the Commissioner any notice, statement, or other document required under the provisions of this section, which is false or untrue or contains any material misstatement of fact, such conduct shall constitute a gross misdemeanor. So when we were needing to pull out the sections and recodify this bill, that came with it, along with everything else that came with the recovery fund enforcement.
So let me ask the question again, Ms. Lepink. Is there a provision in this section that would address it in a civil way, this criminal penalty? Can we do without this criminal penalty? If it is to just make sure that people, we're imposing a gross misdemeanor to make sure that people don't falsely apply?
Again, I'm not going to argue. Are you the pop? Whether it's a good idea?
Let me ask you this: is there another provision in here that addresses or imposes a civil penalty on people who falsely or frivolously apply for the recovery fund?
Madam Chair, there is a general provision in this bill that talks about making a false statement, and I'd have to look to see if it. I think it would apply to individuals who make application. I don't believe there's anything in particular in the recovery fund section that would deal with that, but I know that in the beginning of the bill there's a provision that talks about making a false statement.
Well, members, I was just thinking that if you have to apply and you have to be given the money, and if you don't make the case, then you don't get the money. And so who's going to prosecute, I guess? And it's a gross misdemeanor. I don't see the context in which somebody would actually be prosecuted for a gross misdemeanor. Ms. Lepick.
I'm thinking that if someone were to make a false application to the department for monies from the recovery fund, and we were to learn that, ideally before we gave them the money, we would deny their application.
Correct.
To the extent that we might discover it after the fact, then we might be without
recourse,
i.e. that we wouldn't. I don't believe that there's currently provision in the law that would allow us to recoup improperly paid funds.
Sure. Senator Olson, did you have a question?
Well, Madam Chair, I guess I was just wondering if that wouldn't just fall under a more general. There must be a statute that generally deals with fraud when it comes to attempts to get money from, you know, the government under fraudulent pretenses. That if you were looking for something to put this under as a prosecutor, I would think you could fit it under just a general statute like that. But I'm not sure what Ms. Pontius would think.
Mr. Backus or Ms. Pontius?
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, I believe, you know, there are theft statutes and there's a general theft statute that has a fraud provision as well. So I would think it would be probably prosecutable under the general provision.
Mr. Backus, would that be, is that a criminal fraud provision? Is there a civil fraud provision that the commissioner could use to go after somebody who has swindled the commissioner out of this money? Misrepresented themselves, Mr. Backus?
Madam Chair, members, I'm not aware of any civil fraud provision. I know about the criminal one.
Well, that's up to the committee. I just raise that as a concern. I just feel like a gross misdemeanor just seems to be kind of heavy. Senator Foley.
Madam Chair, I would suggest that we split that.
Madam Chair,
I would think
under the general criminal law, it would depend on the amount of money involved, which would make more sense to me because we might actually be reducing a penalty here. There might be a general penalty that would say that if you had a significant amount of money, this could even be a felony, and it might go all the way down to a misdemeanor. And this way, because it's more specific, we would be superseding any of those general criminal penalties.
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, you'd be correct about that. The theft statute is geared toward the amount that would be, in this case, swindled or defrauded, and it could range anywhere from a 20-year felony down to a misdemeanor under the theft law.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Chair, you come.
I guess that wouldn't be a concern because we have increased the contractor recovery fund payout from $75,000 to $150,000. I don't know how that would fit into that category of criminal statute.
Mr. Joachim, is the payout from the recovery fund capped at
$150,000? Yes, it is. Madam Chair, yes, it is.
Senator Olson.
And Madam Chair and Mr. Joachim, I would think that if someone managed to swindle you out of $150,000 or even attempted to, that you might prefer to have them charged under the current general law that would provide for more severe penalties than reducing it to a gross misdemeanor.
Senator Betzel.
We're talking about Article 8, Section 29.
Subdivision 10.
10, right?
Yes.
This seems to me to say that it's unlawful to file an application with a misstatement. It doesn't say anything about whether you got anything or whether what happened to it. It's just the filing it. And it would seem to me that if you then got some money, that would be a different count of theft by swindle or so forth. I think that the two, could be separate charges. I'm not, I think this is only the filing the application, not what the obtaining money.
Well, and Senator Betzel, that's why initially I thought a gross misdemeanor seemed a little bit heavy, particularly if it's the rationale is that they knowingly filed. And that application then contains a false or untrue or contains any material misstatement of fact. And I think that that would be a factual argument that you would have to, that they knowingly and intentionally submitted information on the application. So that's, my sense is that a gross misdemeanor seems a little bit heavy. If we want to make a reference to if actual money or money after the fact had been sent and that check had been cashed.
Madam Chair, I don't think we need to go there. Yeah. I think all we need to do is simply say that if you file a false statement, there's a penalty. And I think I agree with you that, because it could be a small falsehood, it could be a big lie, I don't know. But I think the worst that they, if it's really, really large, it's still a false statement. And I think that maybe a misdemeanor might be. Now, again, if filing a false statement leads to them getting some money or something that they shouldn't have gotten, I think the other things will kick in.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, I guess I'm just going to some degree disagree with Senator Betzel because most other criminal theft or swindle or misappropriation statutes that we have attempts. We can always have attempts. And if we stop someone in the act, we don't necessarily – we give them a somewhat of a benefit, but we don't go from something that might be a felony with a 20-year statute or a 20-year penalty down to a misdemeanor because we caught them. On the other hand, I would share Senator Moy's concern that if it's a minor thing that wouldn't normally be prosecutable, you know, that we don't want to see someone getting a big penalty for that. So my suggestion would be that we just delete this section and allow the general law that we already have in place that deals with whether this was severe enough to be prosecuted as an attempt under our normal criminal statutes. Because I'm concerned that otherwise we're going to have some people who might be prosecuted for something fairly innocent, but we're going to lose the ability to prosecute for some things that might be very intentional and very severe.
Ms. Lepic.
Where this could be an issue is often when the homeowner brings their claim in conciliation court or district court, it's not a consent. It goes by default. And so because the contractor frequently doesn't show up. And so consequently then whatever the person has claimed, if they think that they're owed or what other problems there may be with their home, you know, they can kind of bring it all forth then, and it's going to go, that adjudication will go uncontested. So therefore it does fall to the department then when they pursue their application with us to carefully look over what it exactly is they're claiming and to be sure that that particular contractor actually caused the harm, you know. And so it can be somewhat complicated in the process of reviewing that application. So ideally you do want to have some expectation of honesty on the part of the homeowners so they don't see this as their opportunity to collect from this fund, you know, their mistake on their back deck in addition to their contractors. But that's, so I just wanted to give you the sort of the posture in terms of what the agency is typically dealing with.
Senator Olson. If that's a concern, Madam Chair, perhaps what we could do is say something, add language to say something like, except as to those acts that would be otherwise subject to statutes that deal with criminal penalties. I don't know exactly how we should put that language together. And then say, you know, go on to say this kind of language here and then maybe reduce the penalty to a misdemeanor since then we're only looking at less severe types of things.
Well, I think that in that context, I guess I would want you to have something of a little hammer to have the applicants submit their documentation. But the application process as it's being reviewed would go back to look at the court's original, the order, and they would do the verification with, assuming someone from your department who is reviewing this application would take the application and say, is this the same set of facts that was presented in the courts? And if your staff person doesn't do that and say a particular, you know, set of documentations were missing or a different set of documentations were submitted to you that weren't presented in the courts, I guess your staff people should catch that.
Madam Chair, we would also be in a position of saying that we realize that you brought your conciliation court claim for all of these things, but based on review of your application, we believe that only these costs are recoverable under the fund. So it could, my experience has been that it's very difficult to get county attorneys to prosecute these sorts of things, particularly when you're coming from the administrative realm. And so consequently, it's best to set up a system that reduces the likelihood that you're going to have this kind of problem in the first place than necessarily to have to turn to the criminal court system to sort of deal with the problems you may have with truthfulness.
And that's exactly my point, Ms. Lepic, is that, you know, if to have a county attorney try to prosecute this versus maybe you ought to try to put something civilly in here that's under your controls other than this criminal penalty. No, Senator Higgins is not new. It just came over. So, Senator Olson, do you still want to make your motion to change that? I think that what you're trying to address is absent, if it's not addressed in this provision, they'll pursue other avenues. So what you're just trying to do is make it more explicit.
Right. I guess I'm just hesitating whether I want to make a motion to just delete this subdivision altogether, which might be the cleaner thing to do, especially if then that would leave them with the op. I think that's what I want to do, because I think if it's serious enough that it falls under general criminal law, it can be prosecuted that way. And based on Senator Moy's comments about if it's a minor, more minor thing, I think I would just prefer to make the motion that simple. So I'd move that subdivision 10 of section...
Just subdivision 10.
Oh, just subdivision 10 be deleted?
Yep. Page 136.
136, lines 14 through 17.
Yep. Any further discussions? Senator Betzel.
Just a clarification, and maybe Mr. Backus can respond to this one. If somebody were to file a false application, would that be grounds for criminal prosecution now because you're attempting to get some benefits? I mean, knowingly false. It's clearly, there's you can prove it beyond a reasonable doubt, but would there be sufficient grounds to prosecute a false application at this time, absent this language?
Mr. Backus?
Madam Chair and Senator Betzold, I mean, I think, the prosecutor would have to determine whether that act of filing the false statement would constitute the attempted theft. And,
sure.
I think that would be up to the prosecutor if they thought they can do that. And oftentimes, we have specific statutes that are, I guess, easier to prove because they're so specific to a situation like this as opposed to the general theft. But usually the general theft covers things like that. So you just have to make a little bit more of an argument to fit it in there.
Any further discussion? Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, if he's comfortable with that, and I don't know if they still want to consider some civil.
Mr. Joachim or Ms. Lepink? Ms. Lepink.
Madam Chair, I would propose that the department's comfortable with Senator Olson's proposed motion, and that why don't we see how this works, and then if we find that we are having problems with false applications, we can explore what might be an effective civil or administrative remedy to deal with it and propose to amend accordingly.
Sure. All right. If there are no further discussions, on Senator Olson's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say nay.
No.
Motion passes. And I think that brings us to the end of the sections that are in our jurisdiction. Any questions for Senator Scheid? See none. Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, we went by this, and I'm sorry, but I'd like to go back to Section 8 of Article 2. And for the reasons that Senator Neville and I were discussing earlier, the concerns about the need to make staff available or to make witnesses available in our court system, I would like to move to delete Section 8 of Article 2.
Page 6.
Mr. Joachim, Ms. Lepik, Senator Scheid, what are your thoughts?
I'm sure, yes, I have some concern. I want to ask Mr. Joachim about, how long we've had the OSHA provision and how has that worked.
Ms. Lepik?
Madam Chair, Senator Scheid, I'm not sure when the no subpoena provision was put in, but I've been representing the Department of Labor and Industry in the OSHA program since 1988, and it has been there since then. So consequently, I can't speak to what would be the consequences for the state of Minnesota, but based on the work I've done with other attorneys general in other states, the significant resources are consumed, investigator time in litigation, particularly when there's a fatality or some other serious injury that consumes significant amounts of inspector time in private personal injury lawsuits. And so they are very interested in the fact that Minnesota has this provision that protects that resource. from experience, since the code units have been in the Department of Labor and Industry, we get several subpoenas a month, or and sometimes more than one a week, for access to our inspector staff. So, and then, of course, the way it works is that you need to appear and sit there until, you know, you may or may not need to be called. So consequently, it does consume significant resources. And furthermore, often what that it requires in addition is, because of the data practices protections for a lot of our investigations, it not only requires the inspector to be available, but it requires staff time to review all the data to be certain to what they can and could not testify to for purposes of the Data Practices Act. And so it does mean a significant utilization of time that is really unrelated to the mandate of the legislature of what you want the agency to be doing. And it is not typically, we are not the only potential witness for what they want testimony about. And so consequently, we're easy and cheap is really what it boils down to. And so consequently, we get called on with some frequency to provide that service. And so really what it is truly a, for the legislature, a policy call as to how you want the state's investigation and support resources to be spent.
Ms. Lepping, how many inspector staff is at the department?
That I'd have to defer.
Mr. Jacob.
Madam Chair, committee members, in the construction codes unit that will be using this enforcement tool, we have 125 staff, full-time staff, and 93 contract inspectors.
And Mr. Jacob, is this throughout the state of Minnesota?
Yes, Madam Chair, yes.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, I guess I would just again say to the department and to the members that I know that this is a burden across the board for any type of professional service, but if we're going to have our civil court system work and if we're going to start excluding people from subpoena power, the next thing will be law enforcement inspectors, because there really is no reason to make a distinction there. We have doctors and many other types of experts in private practice. And if there's, I wouldn't have an objection to charging a reasonable fee if that were something that seems reasonable to charge. And generally, we do allow government witnesses to charge for their time. Law enforcement has that right. But to, when these are the people who are in doing the inspection, and to put a wall around them and not make their testimony available to the court, seems to me that we are doing that at odds with the whole purpose of our civil justice system, which is to allow people to seek justice and get to the truth of issues. It's very expensive for the litigants in these issues, in these cases as well, to get through the have their day in court and to seek justice. And somehow we've kind of gotten to the point as a society where we're looking at civil court cases as if there were some kind of injustice in bringing a court to a case to civil court, and making it more and more difficult and more expensive for civil litigants to actually have their cases heard. So when we have public employees and we're asking them just to be treated the same way as any other witness would be treated, I guess that's something we should consider, is if we have a civil justice system in this country, do we want to allow it to function?
Ms. Lepink, in other agencies, do you have something like this in place for other inspectors in other agencies, like the PCA or other?
Madam Chair, I don't know the answer to that question. I think that the OSHA provision is fairly unique, but I think it's probably was enacted in response to the fact that there was a high demand for that testimony.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, it's my understanding here, for talking just ever so quietly and briefly, that this, they're trying to protect their inspectors from having to just be called as experts when there are other experts out there that are available. This doesn't have to do, apparently, with something where that inspector has actually been to the scene. They're just looking for their expertise. Is that
Ms. Lepig?
It could be where we have done our own inspection, but we could be called either as a fact witness or an expert witness, but it's in a third-party action that is unrelated to the enforcement activity of the agency as to the licensing procedure or code violation procedure. It would be where a homeowner is maybe a warranty action against the builder, where they're arguing that there's a violation of the warranty and they need to show that however the drywall or the foundation was built is a code violation. And so we may have been there and inspected, or another local inspector may have been there to inspect, so they may have be a fact witness, but they also would be called in for their expert opinion as to whether this condition is a violation of the code. And so that would be the typical situation where a contract inspector or a department employee would be called into a third party litigation. And I guess I would maintain that there are other individuals who could observe the construction and would be able to provide an opinion as to whether or not this is a code violation, and it would not require the state inspector to do it.
All right. Senator Higgins.
Senator, are there really not two issues? Isn't the expert witness testimony one issue where, you know, you've got hired guns that you can hire for that? But the inspectors having, who have been at the site and done that kind of work, isn't that a different issue? I mean, those are the kinds of things I think we would want to provide for, you know, whatever litigation is around. Because they're the guys who were the inspector. So I'm thinking that you've got two things linked together here I think I could see getting, banning the expert testimony. That's one thing, but not the other. And maybe it's because I'm not a lawyer. I'm having trouble with this.
Senator Foley, and then we'll come back to Senator
Olson. Thank you, Madam Chair. You might look at the Highway Patrol and how they handle that. They have accident reconstructionists, and so they go to the scene of the accident in the course of their duty, and they're paid salary, but where they do civil testing for attorneys. They just take the data they get. They aren't paid by the state for that. So there is a possibility of extending this so that you can have the recovery of the money from to the company directly to the officer, and there's no cost to that part of it. And they still do on the criminal side by gathering the necessary data.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, I don't want to speak for Senator Neville, but he kind of made a similar point when we were out in the hall that we were talking about, and I think that there is a difference. In fact, the way the language is here now, the court might say that you still are allowed to be called because an expert is a word of art in terms of whether you're qualified as an expert. And so you could still be arguably, although I think this would be perhaps confusing to the court, but there would at least be an argument that you could still be called to give and required to give your testimony, but not as an expert. But what I would suggest is, and I don't have a problem either with someone from your department not just being the convenient or cheap expert if they weren't involved in the case. But I don't think that's really what this is about, because you're talking about testimony about an inspection. So I'm assuming that this has to do with something you were involved with.
Senator Olson, it says except in an enforcement proceeding.
Right.
So if
Madam Chair, the enforcement proceeding would be something they're involved with anyway. It wouldn't be a separate civil action. But where they were involved in going out and doing something, and so they are a witness to it, what I would wonder and would suggest to the department is if we could possibly maybe work with you, if we could delete this section now and come back with something that would give you some protection to not be able to be used as a an expert, a wholesale expert, but that would still allow your testimony in situations where you were directly involved, perhaps with adequate compensation for doing that job?
Senator Olson has a motion on the table. Senator Olson's motion is to strike Article 2, Section 8. Is there any further discussions on that motion? Seeing none. Ms. Lepik?
I'd only make one other comment, too, and that's that in order for the agency to be perceived as being neutral, keeping our people out of private litigation also allows us to maintain that kind of a sense of that the government isn't going to take sides in, and also precludes sort of people being identified as paid for. I mean, once you bring in an expert and you pay them, then the perception is that they're on your pay and they'll say what you want them to say. So consequently, also, when we get involved in this private litigation, it undermines the perception that the state doesn't have a stake in the private litigation. It only has, its interest is code, making sure that the housing stock in Minnesota is built to code. So that's another thing that it gets problematic for having state inspectors be pulled into private litigation. So,
Senator Lummer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The question I have is quite often builders, especially as they were attempting to construct the 2000 energy code, building code, they would follow the directions of what the code exacted from them. Building inspectors would come out and approve it. And yet, even though they did everything seemingly right, the building would still perhaps develop mold or create some problem. And then the particular home buyer would sue the builder. The builder really did everything according to what we as a state told him to do. We even had government officials come out and stamp our approval on every step of that construction. And yet the builder still is a subject to the lawsuit. In this particular case, the way the bill is presented, would that mean that those building inspectors could not be subpoenaed into court to testify that the builder did or did not do it correctly?
Ms. Lepik?
Madam Chair, Senator. If the lawsuit was over whether the state properly performed its duties and was against the state, then clearly we could be subpoenaed into that proceeding. If the private litigation, it would be the facts would be in evidence that we approved the permit or whatever. So the need to have the state come in and confirm that in fact they approved the construction to proceed, I don't know that you would need the state's testimony for that. So I guess I'm trying to get at what proof, if you're trying to prove that they did or didn't violate the code, or you're trying to prove that the department did or didn't do its due diligence in approving that permit, would be two different questions. One would be an action against the state, and one would be whether or not the building was truly up to code. Now, and whether there's a defense then available to the builder that if the department approves it, that then they're good to go. But again, that wouldn't necessarily require expert testimony from the department that whether or not they approve the permit.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, I can see many situations where without the ability to call the inspector to lay the foundation for the inspection, you would not be able to introduce that type of evidence. And I would also just like to remind the members that today we have the department here telling us why it's difficult or inconvenient or expensive
for them to have to be subject to the same subpoena power that every other person, except for one exception they've come up with, is subject to. And who we don't have here today are all the different citizens, the plaintiffs, the defendants, because they could just as easily be on one side or the other, depending on what the result of their inspection was, who aren't here to say that you're taking away a right from us that we would have had if not for this legislation. And they're not here to speak for all the different possible scenarios there might be when this evidence would be helpful or necessary to them. Again, I don't think when law enforcement comes into court and testifies about their findings in a particular criminal case or accident situation that we say that they're becoming improperly involved in the case or taking sides. They're just giving the basis of their findings and what they did to do their job. So sometimes state employees get caught up in situations where they have to offer an opinion just like people do in private life.
All right, members, I'm ready to take a vote on this motion from Senator Olson to strike Article 2, Section 8. If there are no further discussions, all those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed say nay.
No.
No. Motion passes.
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, when you take that section out, I think the implication was that we would continue to work on language because that's not acceptable to leave it as it is. I think that we need to do some work and try to and differentiate between when you're being called as an expert and when you're being called as an actual person who witnessed, who did the inspection. So we certainly intend to work on that.
Senator Neville.
I would agree with that. And in addition, to the extent that you are called as an expert in any case where you don't even do an inspection, clearly I would prohibit that.
Mm-hmm.
I think you said that happens from time to time. So if it does, craft some new language, clearly prohibit that. But the reason I supported taking that out for now is it even prohibits providing testimony or documents, which is factual information, and the documentary definition is really broad. I mean, it may be you'll be the only person with that factual information, and the only way to get it is to subpoena it from you. So when you rewrite it, right, at the very least, you've got to keep the factual stuff in. It makes sense to me.
Senator Scheid?
And I move that Senate File 998, as amended, be recommended to pass by
Finance, I guess. They don't need to see it. And be referred to the Committee on Finance, Senator Scheid. I understand it's going to be amended onto a bigger bill in the Finance Committee. Very good. Any further discussions? Is there anybody here who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say nay. Motion passes.
Thank you.
Senate File 1805 has been taken off the agenda, so we're done for the day. Thank you very much. We're now adjourned.